That's it for the Inside Scoop. Tomorrow I debate Republican Mike Lane, and you can join in the debate and ask him the hard questions. I'm going to be asking him about Monica Goodling. I want you to, too. For now, this is Mark Levine signing off.
This is the Quality News Network. Stocks rallied today with the Dow Jones and the S&P 500 closing at all-time highs and the NASDAQ at a new six-year high. We'll have the numbers coming up in our business segment. Officials from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are aggressively looking for passengers sitting near a man with a dangerous form of tuberculosis. The infected man traveled on several flights on Air France to multiple countries in Europe on or around May 12th. The patient is under quarantine at the CDC in Atlanta. President Bush and Soviet President Vladimir Putin will meet in July. The meeting comes at a time when Soviet-American relations are said to be at their lowest point since the Soviet era. Yesterday, Russia test-fired an intercontinental ballistic missile with multiple warheads. Today, Putin warned that U.S. plans for an anti-missile shield would be a mistake. President Bush will provide $30 billion for AIDS in Africa, which will double the funding. White House spokesman Tony Snow said, Bush's recent announcement about sanctions against Darfur, the new president of the World Bank, and AIDS funding are taken in advance of next week's Group of Eight summit in Germany. Trade negotiator Robert Zelnick has been appointed by the president to replace former World Bank president Paul Wolfowitz, who was forced to resign over allegations of nepotism. His appointment must still be endorsed by the bank's 24-member board of directors. Former Tennessee senator and Law and Order actor Fred Thompson is moving toward a presidential bid. The 64-year-old has a conservative record in the Senate, and recent polls show he would fare well against the other candidates. In London, British negotiators meet today to work out a strategy to win the release of five British civilians who were seized yesterday in Iraq. The hostages were taken out of the Finance Ministry office by gunmen dressed in police uniforms and driving security forces vehicles. Six people are dead after 3 days and four nights of flooding in central Texas. At least three of the deaths occurred when people were trapped on flooded roads. Tropical Storm Barbara is the first tropical storm to kick off the season, which officially begins June 1st. Barbara is off the coast of Mexico and expected to make landfall in Acapulco in the next few days. Tropical Storm Alvin is the first in the eastern Pacific. You're listening to QNN, Science and Business, next.
It's not hard to find people in need. They're everywhere. And there's more than one kind of disaster that affects people's lives. There's AIDS and the millions of orphans the disease has left behind. There are teeming refugee camps, the result of war and persecution. Mary Knoll has been reaching out to the world's needy for nearly a century. Mary Knoll is there right now, in 40 countries around the world. And with your help, Mary Knoll will be there tomorrow. Call us at 877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 877-MARY-KNOLL. Or, for more information, go to www.mygiftcounts.org. One world, one mission, Mary Knoll.
Delta and Dawn are missing, and biologists say that's a good sign. The two lost whales are presumed to be out in the Pacific Ocean following a misguided trip down the Sacramento River. Japan told delegates at the International Whaling Commission meeting the country will continue to hunt humpback whales, despite the majority of delegates voting against the plan. Japanese commercial fishermen catch approximately 1,000 whales each year. IBM laid off 1,500 people from its technology services unit. The downsizing follows a similar layoff at the beginning of May. That's more than 3,000 job cuts this quarter. IBM executives say they expect no more layoffs this quarter. Ford Motors announced it expects a sales increase in the U.S. for May, the first increase in 6 months. However, the automaker says overall revenues may continue to drop as sales to rental companies decline. Nigeria's new president has promised to put an end to the violence in the oil-rich Niger Delta, which has disrupted oil production in recent years. Nigeria provides 8% of OPEC's oil supply. And light sweet crude is trading at $63.49 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. The Dow Jones closed up 111 points at 13,633. The NASDAQ closed up 20 points today. The S&P 500 was up 12 points. There's more news at QualityNewsNetwork.com.
Okay! Don't you!
South America!
Now, Head On with Bob Kincaid. Head On is brought to you every night by the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. Union Carpenters and Millwrights, they're building the American dream. Free speech isn't free if you don't use it, so call Bob now at 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Now, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! One more spin of this sweet little blue-green marble, this sweet little time machine, hurtling through the universe, and it is Wednesday here at the fabulous Head On Studios here in the hills and hollers of an undisclosed location in West Virginia. I'm Bob Kincaid, and I'm thrilled to pieces to be with you, especially because, after all, it is Wednesday, and you know what that means.
On this every other Wednesday afternoon discussion club, we are going to have more to discuss on this every other Wednesday afternoon than we ever had on any other every other Wednesday afternoon.
Darn straight, it's prayer meeting edition, while the right wing heads off to their little religion industry clavering meetings on Wednesday night. We sit by and we have fun with their abject freakishness. And we've got some freakishness for you this evening. Of course we do. Of course we do. A little program note for you. Coming up at about 5 minutes past the next hour, we will be joined by Joe Badgent. God, I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. I hope it's not Bajon. Or something equally unpronounceable. But he's Scots-Irish. It's going to be Joe. It's got to be Badgent. I don't think I'm getting it wrong. I've been corresponding with Joe, and what a darn fine writer he is. His essays are available over at joebadgent.com. That's J-O-E. I figure you've probably got that part. Badgent, B-A-G-E-A-N-T. JoeBadgent.com Badgent.typepad.com. He is an essayist. He is an observer of the culture, with a particular emphasis and fondness, such as I also maintain for, shall we say, the south of the Mason-Dixie line part of the culture. Now, there are some words involved in the way that Joe writes, and I'm going to say some of them. So, you know, for God's sakes, hide the children. Because, you know, words kill. I just want to tease you. I want to make you go read his stuff. Our good buddy Cossack has sent me a number of Joe's articles, and in fact, that's where I got turned on, and I love it. In an article entitled "Redneck Liberation Theology," Joe writes, subtitled "Why Are Leftists So Damn Afraid of God?" Joe writes, 6 or 7 years ago, I wrote my first essays about how America's fundamentalist churches had gone batshit crazy, were casting demons out of car engine blocks and making covert plans to exchange the Constitution for the Book of Revelation. Those few readers I had at the time, mostly in urban liberal strongholds, tended to think, well, these hayseeds out there in the hinterlands are scary fuckers, but Joe overstates the case a bit. The Godwacks can never put together the kind of political power he's describing. The political landscape has changed since then, and there are now more books and documentary films sounding the alarm than you can shake a stick at, which warms the gin-soaked cockles of my heart, whatever the hell cockles are. That's just a, you know, that's just a soupçon of what you'll find. So I encourage you to go and have a read, and what's more important, and the reason that Joe is out there hitting the bricks, so to speak, is there's a new book coming out, and it's not out yet. It'll be out next month. When it is, I would like for you to go and purchase it, because I consider Joe a kindred spirit in the fight. Anybody who writes like that has to be, doesn't he? But yes, the new book is coming out in June. It's already posted over at Amazon. If you order through one of the links on our site, through the Horn Store, whatever, I think we get 1/12 of 1% of 1/1,000,000th of a penny by the way of commission. And that might pay for a phone call. Woohoo! Don't spend it all in one place, Agnes. The name of the book is Deer Hunting with Jesus. Yeah, I think we're going to have fun next hour. How about you? Yeah, I think so. So, you know, that's a special Wednesday night prayer meeting edition conversation. How do you not put a guy on prayer meeting night who's put out a book called Deer Hunting with Jesus? Sure. So I think we're gonna have a fabulous conversation, and I hope you'll enjoy it as much as I plan on it. But beyond that, there are other things. You know, Congress is in recess. They get the week off for Memorial Day. Do you get the week off for Memorial Day, Sunshine? I didn't think so. I didn't either. Didn't get the memo. Or the $140,000 a year salary. Or the best health care plan on earth. Or just absolutely killer retirement benefits. And I don't get to keep all the campaign contributions that I hustle out of pharmaceutical companies and gun manufacturers and bomb builders and screaming jet makers and all of that. No, I don't. Or coal companies or railroad companies. I don't get... Nope, sorry, not me. Mm-mm. Of course, I'm also not out there trying to keep people from building windmills so that coal can be protected. God, you gotta love that corporate welfare, don't you? Yeah. So, there is a bunch of other stuff out there. Something that I ended, by the way, a little prescription for making your life a little bit better, especially to the daddies out there. If you're stressing out at the end of the day, or if, like me, you go to work in the evening, when your boy comes and says, "Let's throw the ball for a little bit, Dad." Go throw the ball for a little bit. It will make you feel manifestly better. I took my sunburned lobster hide out for about 10 minutes. It's all there was before the show. And that little left-handed delight, my son, made my palm sore just whizzing the ball into the mitt. And the whole world went away, and that's all there was me and him. I highly recommend it. I highly recommend it. I hope that I can get back into the swing of doing it myself more often. Now there was a topic I wanted to hit last night because it's been on my mind again, and this is kind of related. This is stuff that I think about now that I'm a parent. You know, we've been at this parent gig. I've been at it for 14 years now, and you're never, you know, it's kind of like medicine and law. They refer to both of them as practicing it because you never get it entirely right. But there is stuff out there that you pay attention to when you're a parent that you don't pay attention to when you are a swinging, happening bachelor guy. just out there. Well, no, we won't go into the gory details. But anyway, one of those things is toothpaste. You get up in the morning, you know, if you're an unparent, and you brush your teeth, and you brush your teeth two or three times during the day. Maybe you're super good about it, and you're the delight of your dentist, and you floss constantly, and all of that. But you know, you brush your teeth and you move on. When you've got kids, however, you have to say, "Go brush your teeth." You have to create the tooth-brushing mindset, because apparently it's not something that comes immediately to mind. You have to build that, and you work with the dentist to reinforce the dental hygiene and the floss and the... Yeah. And so you think you're doing a good thing with this. Go brush your teeth. Oh, you're done with lunch? Go brush your teeth. Dinner's over. Go brush your teeth. Good morning, go brush your teeth. Trying to build that routine, that habit. And again, you think you're doing the right thing as a parent by doing it, and by all rights, you are. There's no end to the misery that comes from not taking care of one's teeth. But here in more and more obviously screwed up America, it's not as easy as it appeared to be. Toothpaste. I said to someone in the chat room last night, you should have seen me screaming at the windshield driving down the road last weekend, because there was nobody in the vehicle but me. And, you know, the 600-mile drive, it gets kind of... And you talk to things. Windshields, other cars, cattle by the side of the road. Moo. And so I'm listening to some public... I think it was actually BBC News, made possible via American Public Media or some such. And there was a feature on toothpaste. Yeah, and that's the thing I love about long-form radio like National Public Radio and American Public Media that does, some of the better news that's available. You can hear stuff that you're damn sure not going to get on, I'm Doug Limerick. For three and a half minutes at the top of the hour with a minute and a half of commercial matter. Yes, I said move. But I'm listening to this thing about toothpaste, which seems rather, shall we say, a prosaic topic, to say the least. Toothpaste. Well, do you like your cinnamon or mint? Will you wonder where the yellow went when you buy Pepsodent? Is it close up? For a close-up, fresh breath, smile, kissable face kind of thing. You too, Agnes. But it turns out that in this increasingly screwed-up country, we have screwed up toothpaste. And after I heard this report, which essentially said that, there's no getting around it. I mean, I'm not burying the lead or anything. It's not like there's a real snapper here. Ooh, you've got my golden arm. No. China has become the world's number one producer of toothpaste. In other words, to the rest of that list that we have of people chained to tables doing things in China, whether it's making tennis shoes or the shirts for Walmart or cheap particle board stereo stands for Walmart and all the other chain discount department stores, we can now add toothpaste. And when I got home, I went into the bathroom and I opened the medicine cabinet and I took out the couple of tubes of toothpaste there and I looked because I expected to see Made in the USA. It's toothpaste! Jiminy Christmas, it's toothpaste! I looked at a tube of AIM, and it said, distributed in the United States by. I looked at a tube of Close-Up, and it said, distributed in the United States by. And I looked at a little one of those mini travel tubes of Colgate. Colgate! The Colgate Palmolive Company! Arthur Godfrey! Distributed in the United States by. Guess where it all came from? In what? I can't. Somebody with the background in packaging or whatever can straighten me out. I mean, does it come in a 55-gallon drum? Does it come in a 5,000-gallon tanker car that comes right off the boat and gets set on the rails and goes to wherever they fill toothpaste tubes? I don't know, but it wasn't made here. And I guess this is going to make me, so far I must be sounding terribly protectionist. I'm not protectionist. I'm just a little bit stunned. How in the hell is it that the United States of America, the nation that 60-some years ago defeated fascism and saved the world, can't make toothpaste anymore? Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, it's toothpaste. Here's why I care. In the making of toothpaste, apparently part of the recipe... Agnes, wait. No, you're going to quit laughing at me in a minute.
I'm not laughing.
Yeah, no, you're not. I know. You're not laughing at me. You're laughing with me. I ain't laughing, okay? Apparently, one of the principal ingredients of toothpaste is either glycerin or propyl. Yeah, I think it's glycerin. I believe it's glycerin. But if you want to be cheap and you want to apply the maximum capitalist model of maximizing profits while minimizing quality, you can dummy up and gin up and fake up the recipe by parting in something called diethylene glycol. Chemistry people can let me know. Well, guess what? A few weeks ago, I saw, and you probably saw as well, a story about Panamanian children dying. That would be dead, as in dying, from using Chinese toothpaste. Chinese toothpaste that had diethylene glycol faked into the formula instead of the more expensive either glycerin or propylene glycol. I can't remember which. And I read it and I went, oh, poor little Panamanian children. Poor little Panamanian children. If only they... And then I immediately flashed on the... Well, you know, if we had the Panama Free Trade Agreement, they'd be able to brush with Colgate, and they wouldn't be dropping dead from using substandard Chinese toothpaste. Boy, was I wrong. Guess what? Same stuff comes here. The same country that has poisoned thousands of our pets, our beloved pets, no country quite fetishizes its pet population the way the United States does. The country that has sold us food-grade, melamine-tainted wheat gluten, that's food-grade, has also allowed manufacturers, in the name of a yuan or a dollar, to fake out the toothpaste recipe. The toothpaste recipe. With a substance which, if ingested by a human being, kills them deader than a stump. And they die because mommies and daddies say, go brush your teeth again. Because mommies and daddies are trying to do the right thing. Do the right thing by their children. What an incredibly screwed up place we have allowed America to become, all in the name of globalization and free trade, lovey, free trade. And yeah, we're going to have us a free trade agreement with Panama and with Peru that got snuck in the middle of the night. We're so free traded up with China we can barely stand it. And the cost of that free trade has been Fido and Fluffy the kitty cat. The cost of that free trade agreement has been diethylene glycol, a deadly, deadly poison in the toothpaste by which you try to do right by your little kids. Does it make you want to scream? I mean, does it make you just want to have a full-on, full-bore, no-holds-barred fit? Toothpaste. We risk our children's lives because Colgate-Palmolive found it cheaper to manufacture toothpaste in China and take the litigation risk, and they're pretty well protected from that now, thanks to the Bush administration's assault on the courts. It's called economics people, help me here. It was the same thing with the Ford Pinto. Calculated risk? No. That's an economic term. It's where you know you're going to pay out X amount in judgments, but the amount you're going to make in profit is greater, so you make a conscious judgment to go ahead and kill people in the name of upping your corporate share price on the quarter. Colgate-Palmolive can't manufacture toothpaste. The people who make AIM and Close Up and Colgate and Crest and Pepsodent and name some more can't do it in America anymore because it's 2 cents cheaper to do it in China, and the reason it's 2 cents cheaper to do it in China is because the Chinese make it with poison. And so, once again, American workers get screwed. And mommies and daddies wonder why Junior is sick. Was it something he ate? Was it E. coli 157H7 in the meat? You know, the stuff that grows in poop. Maybe it was E. coli 157H7 on the spinach, because the spinach had been dragged through poop. No, we haven't had any hamburgers, we haven't had any spinach, and he brushes his teeth faithful like, oh my God, the toothpaste got him. But free trade is more important than our children's future. Okay, I guess I'm just really off base on this. Agnes has been looking at me like I got three heads. I'm sorry. I was astonished because I had read the Panama story, and I really did think it was a problem in the third world where they had to buy cheap poisonous toothpaste. Then I hear this thing going down the road, going, "No, America, sucker, you get it too. The number one producer of toothpaste in the world is China, and you get it by the train car load." And I was horrified when I looked at those tubes and I saw, distributed by, not manufactured by. imported by. And we don't even have the right to know it, and we don't, and the Food and Drug Administration is so crippled that it can't even warn us about it. Jesus. I tell you what, we'll take a break. Your phone, hey, it's prayer meeting night. 30 minutes here before we have our conversation with Joe Badgett. Let's converse and cuss and discuss a little bit if you want to. This is the Head On Radio Network. This is America's liberal voice. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Harry Potter has given us all a unique glimpse at education the way it ought to be. Never once do Harry and his Hogwarts friends talk about skipping class, ducking tough instructors, waiving requirements, or shirking responsibilities. That perspective, be practical, get it the easiest, fastest, cheapest way you can, is what J.K. Rowling terms the Muggle approach to education. We're Concord University, and do we have a deal for you? At Concord, education's different than anywhere else around. There's a reason that Concord students get the best jobs, are sought out by the best medical, graduate, and law schools in the land. It's no wonder that Concord has been cited by U.S. News & World Report and by the Wall Street Journal. Where do I sign up? At Southern West Virginia's version of Track 9 and 3 Quarters. All you have to do is believe, and believe in yourself. Concord University, an education you can put to work. 1-888-384-5249.
Hey, kids. There are some questions about what's this new gay conversation radio show coming in June on the Head On Radio Network. Well, the details are safely locked away in my closet, located on a dirt road in the rural South. So the next time you're traveling on an interstate highway, staring out into the red state abyss, just smile and think to yourself, honey, we're everywhere.
Baby, I got your number. Oh, and I know that you got mine. You know that I called you. I called too many times. You can call me, baby. You can call me anytime. You got to call me.
I never thought my daughter and I would ever think the same thing is cool.
And how my boys are like a wrecking ball. But when they volunteer, they're actually shaping things up.
Hey, they plant a tree at the local park. Clean the place up.
She makes new friends. She has a great time.
My son loves it. He's contributing.
These are nice kids.
The Are You Into It volunteer program is a great way for you and your kids to make a difference in the community while making friends. So, if you're into it, or you think your kid might be, call 4-H toll-free at 1-888-77-YOUTH. Or visit our website at www.areyouintoit.com.
We can't get him to clean his room, but he loves volunteering.
A public service message brought to you by 4-H, the Cooperative Extension System, and the Ad Council.
Pleasure, the need to cry.
everybody dance. Backward skate. Couple skate. 25 minutes before the hour, I'm Bob. And we go directly to the phones. Our good buddy Alan, the trucker, is calling in. Hey, Alan, how are you? Thanks for calling. Helps if you push the button there, Agnes. No, you got the wrong slide.
Sorry.
Alan, we'll make this thing work someday.
Can you hear me now?
I got you now.
Okay, I'm down here in Plainview, Texas.
Oh, my.
Nice day.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I'm on the internet, and I'm looking at this website by Common Cause.
Mm-hmm.
I've always heard of this organization. It sounds like a good organization to support. What do you know about it?
Frankly, I can't tell you a whole lot, Alan, but I've got the same impression that you have. They have always, as far as I know, taken positions that are fundamentally humane, I guess, is the humane and forward-thinking is the best I can say.
Yeah, I think I've always thought of them as the organization really fights corporate power in government. And also it sounded like that they gave a lot, they did a lot to end the Vietnam War and stopping the funding. They had a lot to do with that, the way I understand. And believe it or not, it was started by a Republican.
Do you happen to know which one? Of course, I guess this is back when the Republican Party had a little bit of integrity left to it.
Yeah, I believe so. His name is John Gardner.
Okay. Well, I'll have to read up on it some.
Okay. Well, maybe somebody else knows a lot more about it than I do or you do, so they call in and let us know. And I'll be listening. I appreciate you taking my call, though.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Alan. You stay safe, all right?
Okay, thank you.
All right, take care.
Goodbye.
Bye now. I will have to read up. I'm looking at the website now. You gotta love them. There's a little banner on the Common Cause site that says, if Baghdad can vote, why can't D.C.? Makes a lot of sense. Our good friend Dave is calling in from Humboldt County, California. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
How are you?
I am pretty great. Yourself?
I'm moderately horrified. I'm sure it'll get worse.
Well, I know I don't need to tell you about it, but I feel often the need to rant a bit because our government is clearly in the hands of very deceitful, hardcore criminals. They don't care how much harm they do. Any agency of government that is in place to help or protect or benefit the people, they're trying to cut it back every way they can. And they're appointing their moniker, what the heck, the
Goodling.
Yeah, to be there to turn it all into some kind of a fundamentalist, shoot all the wealth of the Republicans kind of an operation.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in line with that, we've seen over the course of the Bush administration in particular, the deliberate weakening of every agency of government, every arm of government that has any interest whatsoever in doing public good. Now we find out, I saw an article today, I don't know if you ran across it yet, Dave, I saw this article that said the federal government knew about this guy who was flying back and forth with this particularly virulent brand of tuberculosis. Did you see that?
Yes. Uh-huh.
They knew. The guy was coming back and forth, and they knew, and still nothing. Didn't stop him.
You're saying the government officials knew he was doing this?
Yeah.
Oh, my. I wonder why. See, now, maybe it is.
And now they're desperately trying to track down the people who sat next near him, because they may well have contracted a death sentence out of Republican bureaucratic negligence.
You know, so much of what they do appears not to be just neglect. We don't care what happens to you. It seems like willful hurt, that causing grief is one of the ways they get their kicks, I think.
Well, I saw an article today about the Republican Party's implosion, and I believe it came from The New Yorker, where there was a snippet in there from Tom DeLay basically just deriding Newt Gingrich, and you know, God forbid anybody should deride Newt Gingrich, that I didn't get to do it first. But saying, you know, and what he said, what DeLay said, Dave, is that, well, you know, Gingrich is out there now, and he's got this phony new idea of, you know, government solutions. He's forgotten the government's, and these were DeLay's words, the government is not the solution, the government is the problem. They're still, you know, they're still at that. And so that goes to the heart of what you just said. Yeah, it's not just some sort of simple neglect. This is overt hostility toward any portion of the government established by we the people that could help we the people.
You know, I fear right now if we could put together any combination of Al Gore, Dennis Kucinich, John Edwards, you know, good, capable people, can it be turned around? Can this country be saved? I mean, it's in debt for how many thousands of, you know, trillions of dollars. That's going to be a devastating thing to try to deal with itself.
Right, and as the oil weapon becomes more pernicious and more pervasive, we're only going to find that debt going up. You asked the $64 million question, Dave, can it be saved? And I was thinking the other day, you know, because I've got a fascination with ancient history, that kind of thing. You know, the people of Rome came to the same crossroads that we have come to. They got to a point, their consuls served, they elected two consuls every year, and the consuls served for 1 year, and then, you know, sorry, later, you're gone, and you didn't get to be consul again. And they got to a point where their problems were greater than their government could address. And I fear that we've gotten to that point too, because no sooner does a guy get into office, into the presidency, than if he hopes to get any good work done, he has immediately got to start running for his second term, because that's all he gets.
Maybe there will be a burning of America like it happened in Rome.
Well, that was so much more localized. I don't think it happens that way, but I think we see a general, and it is part and parcel of this assault that has been launched on our government by these anti-American, right-wing, neoconservative, conservative, Republican SOBs. It's part and parcel of what they've done. They want to break government because they do not like the structure of the government that they have, whether it's the right-wing religion industry that wants to set up a theocratic state, or the right-wing corporatists who want to set up a corporatist plutocracy or oligarchy or whatever. The first step has to be to break the government as it exists.
Well, I wasn't literally referring to the burning of it. I don't know. It doesn't bring much comfort, I don't think, to either of us to know that W has his thumb on the nuclear football and the way he thinks.
No, if you spend any time at all thinking about that, you wake up in a cold sweat every night.
It makes you wonder if you're going to get through the program, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it does. You know, And what's coming down the pike? You know, this story that we had at the top of the hour news, and I'm reading today, that Fred Thompson has all but decided that he's going to run for president. You know, this guy's just Reagan Redux. He's another right-wing Republican empty suit who will spout platitudes while everything continues to go to hell.
Well, I love your program. I love your network, and stay with the good work.
Well, thank you, Dave. I'm sorry to be such a bummer.
No, I know. I mean, I'm being a bummer back at you. I'd love to see more of a hope that something could be done. But, you know, I get the attitude from this administration of the hell with you. We don't care how you vote. We don't care how you think. We control all that. And we'll decide who should be in office.
Yeah, and if we want to have ourselves a little war, we'll take this volunteer military and we'll break it into a million pieces, having our little war. And if we want another war, we'll do an air war on Iran. I mean, my God, Dave, there was an editorial in the Wall Street Journal today openly begging George Bush to start the bombing of Iran.
Wall Street Journal is begging him to do it?
Yes.
You know, that must mean it's strictly going to be another very profitable venture, controlling the oil fields of Iran. It's wonderful for Wall Street.
Let's see. Here's what the Wall Street Journal wrote, Dave. In short, the plain and brutal truth is that if Iran is to be prevented from developing a nuclear arsenal, there is no alternative to the actual use of military force. any more than there was an alternative to force if Hitler was to be stopped in 1938. Since a ground invasion of Iran must be ruled out for many different reasons, the job would have to be done, if it is to be done at all, by a campaign of airstrikes. Furthermore, because Iran's nuclear facilities are dispersed, and because some of them are underground, many sorties and bunker-busting munitions would be required. And because such a campaign is beyond the capabilities of Israel and the will, let alone the courage, of any of our other allies, it could be carried out only by the United States. Even then, we would probably be unable to get at all the underground facilities, which means that if Iran were still intent on going nuclear, it would not have to start over again from scratch. But a bombing campaign would, without question, set back its nuclear program for years to come and might even lead to the overthrow of the mullahs.
I don't believe a word of that. Just you know, the history of Iran through Persia, they've never been an invading country. They've never attacked anyone else.
Well, except when you go back to, like, Cyrus and Xerxes and those guys, but, yeah.
How many dozens, well, of other countries have nuclear weapons and that are a lot less stable than Iran?
Pakistan? Yeah. Pakistan is one hair on a baboon's butt away from a bunch of mullahs that are a lot crazier, every bit as crazy or crazier than anybody in Iran, having a much more well-developed nuclear arsenal.
Yeah.
But we're not particularly bothered by that.
No.
India won't even sign off on the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and we are giving them nuclear technology in exchange for mangoes.
There's so much deception. So much deception coming out of it. I can't believe the Wall Street Journal would take that kind of a stance, though. That's lying for the administration to try to justify their plans for more profit in the Middle East.
Well, this was written by Norman Podhoretz. You know, he's a darling of the neocon right. And yeah, it's there. I mean, I didn't even read all of it.
You read enough to turn you off, I'm sure.
I read enough to make me scream, make me want to scream for the rest of the night, Dave.
Yeah.
And I really fret, Dave. And I'm not sitting here crying on your shoulder. I hope I don't.
We're crying on each other.
I worry about the world that I'm handing off to some children that I love a lot, and some grandchildren. And a world that I hope to live in for a little while longer and try to make a better place. And at the same time, I know there are so many others who feel the same way, and yet we're sitting here, and while we're sitting, these murderous, bloodthirsty sons of bitches are plotting World Wars 4 through 8.
Criminals of the worst order.
And how do you stop them? By turning into them? I can't countenance that.
I think we ought to put one of their prisons to use, one of their torture prisons, and move them all out of the White House into that.
I mean, can we take Norman Podhoretz and move him into a little mud hut in Iraq and let him see what it feels like when the American fighter jets come over and bomb neighborhoods? Would that change anything?
Would change his thinking if you have a direct hit on him, I suppose.
Well, that would end his thinking. if what he is doing you can call thinking. See, this is an onion, Dave. It's a problem that has layer after layer after layer.
Well, I'm also convinced that a lot of these right-wing dinners are being paid, that the cons are reaching down into our treasury and pulling out money and handing it to them. A couple good cards. I can remember Armstrong Williams. But I think that they're being given real big monetary incentive to be closers in a used car lot, trying to sell this terrible product to us at too much of a high price. That's what I think is going on. I don't think anybody that's rational and thinking could hold to the views that they are espousing. They are there to sell the deal, to lie for them.
Well, Dave, I wish I was the Shell Answer Man or something. I'm convinced that it's criminals. You know, it's like the old question about the old lady asking the Hindu guru about the origins of the universe, and She said, you know, I understand it's a, the earth is held up by an elephant standing on top of the turtle. And, you know, what, she asked him, what does the turtle stand on? And he said, it's turtles all the way down. I think that's where we are in our American corporatist structure. It's turtles all the way down. You can wander around looking for somebody honest in that world, but you will spend a lifetime of frustration and heartbreak. There aren't any. There's no one left in corporate America who loves America.
Well, I heard one thing that kind of made something start making sense. I heard that recently a brilliant scientist announced that he had solved the age-old problem of the evolutionist. He had discovered the missing link between the gorilla and civilized man, and it's us.
God, yeah, I know.
And then a lot of things start fitting. Oh, I understand.
Yep, indeed. Dave, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, brother.
Hang in there, brother. Hang in there. All right, bye now. Wow. Agnes, a little quicker on the draw there, would you? That hurt.
I guess.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I've got my phone on.
Yeah, sorry. Just this Wall Street, I read I read it over at Editor and Publisher. This is excerpted. Now, here's the part of Norman Podoritz's screed that applies to you and me. The opponents of bombing, not just the usual suspects, but many both here and in Israel, who have no illusions about the nature and intentions and potential capabilities of the Iranian regime, disagree that it might end in the overthrow of the Mullahocracy. On the contrary, they are certain that all Iranians, even the democratic dissidents, would be impelled to rally around the flag. And this is only one of the worst-case scenarios they envisage. To wit, Iran would retaliate by increasing the trouble it is already making for us in Iraq. It would attack Israel with missiles armed with non-nuclear warheads, but possibly containing biological or chemical weapons. There would be a vast increase in the price of oil, with catastrophic consequences for every economy in the world, very much including our own. The worldwide outcry against the inevitable civilian casualties would make the anti-Americanism of today look like a love fest. I readily admit that it would be foolish to discount any or all of these scenarios. Each of them is, alas, only too plausible. Nevertheless, there is a good response to them, and it is the one given by John McCain. The only thing worse than bombing Iran, McCain has declared, is allowing Iran to get the bomb. There is no assailing that kind of reason, really, is there? The only thing worse than not burning down your neighbor's house before he burns down yours is, huh? Can't make it work. Can you? It's the same old crap. It would attack Israel with missiles armed with non-nuclear warheads, but possibly containing biological or chemical weapons. Where's the proof? Damn it! We have been down this road once before. Where is the proof? Prove to me that Iran wants to use biological or... Well, they used them against Iraq. Well, Iraq used them against them, and they used it to their mutual disadvantage. You shoot the poison gas over, then the wind changes, and your people wind up dying. It's stupid! And we're not talking about stupid people. Lord, 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 Lord. This is the Wall Street Journal. I know they're on the other side of the ideological fence from me. I know I'm not bound to agree with them very often, if at all, because they're aiming at a different class of American than me. Their concerns are not my concerns. Right? Right. But to openly and nakedly argue not just for a bomb here and a bomb there, but a sustained campaign, a full-on war with civilian casualties that would probably make Iraq pale by comparison. Why is Norman Podoritz allowed to walk around in civilized society? Why isn't he in a rubber room somewhere with a purple crayon between his toes writing this crap on a wall? God! And the thing is, there are people in the White House and in the Bush administration and in the vice presidential residence going, yeah, definitely, that's what we got to do. Yeah, definitely, bomb slow on the driveway, that's it. Oh. Because that is the beginning of the end. That's not the end of the beginning, that's the beginning of the end, Mr. Churchill. Because then everything really does go to caca. When you back them up against the wall, what else do they have to do? You want to make sure... See, some of this... Remember, this is Prayer Meeting Edition, and it is worth noting that some of this is driven by a theological desire to get a firestorm started over Israel... so that Jesus will come back in his golden rolls. That freak Falwell hasn't been in the ground for 2 weeks yet, I don't think, and I'm still remembering, well, the Antichrist is alive today and he's probably a Jewish man. Remember that? I do. Our good friend Mark Levine was talking about the Palestinian versus Israeli conflict in his program before mine, and frankly, I have a hard time with that thing sometimes because because it is guaranteed to split liberals and progressives right down the middle, with some people thinking that Israel has a greater right to survive than the Palestinians and other people thinking the Palestinians have a greater right to survive than the Israelis, and virtually nobody standing in the middle going, I think they should all survive. And, you know, we'll stop bulldozing houses and killing babies, Israel will, if the Hamas will stop shooting rockets. And Hamas says we'll stop shooting rockets if the Israelis will quit bulldozing our babies. And each side sitting there going, nah, 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 you did it first. No, you did it first. And nothing gets fixed and the blood just runs as high as your kneecaps. Screw them all. Reminds me of the Bible verse, the mistranslated Bible verse from the Christmas story, where, you know, the most of the English-speaking world thinks it says, peace on earth, goodwill toward men. Bug spray, it doesn't say that. It says, peace on earth to men of goodwill. Because they are the only ones entitled to peace. If you are of bad will, screw you. Screw the Israelis of bad will. Screw the Arabs of bad will. The Palestinians of bad will. The Iranians of bad will. The Pakistanis of bad will. And yes, by God, screw the Americans of bad will. Because they see to their own screwing. It makes me nuts. Because, among other things, there are factions in Israel that are more than happy to have the support of people like Ted Hagee. Is that his name? Ted, Pastor Hagee, who's formed his, you know, let's help Jesus come back now committee, and has little marches at the UN and such silly crap as that. And they don't understand that by sitting there and needling and begging and digging and digging and digging and gouging for war, that when the bombs fly over Iran, there's a tremendous likelihood that all hell will break loose. And it'll break loose smack dab over Tel Aviv and Haifa and, yes, maybe even Jerusalem. But they don't care. Because war is what they're used to. War is what they know. War is what they have studied. And war is, by God, what they want. and a pox upon them all. And somebody, for God's sakes, trot Norman Podoritz away to a padded cell with one of those funky white dinner jackets that have this, has the sleeve that tie in the back, before he can convince some freak in the White House to actually do this. Oh, it's time for a news break. And I'm going to get my wits together before we talk to Joe Badgett. God bless us all, for we will not bless ourselves. This is the Head On Radio Network. This is The Horn, America's liberal voice, and I'm Bob Kincaid.
And the devil's cruel temptations. I know that we will all get there one day.
One day.
After years and years of wandering, oh, the kingdom we shall find. And the doors may not be open, but we'll gather in the line. And our hearts will swell with pride the day those gates swing open wide. And we take a walk down Main Street, USA. Oh, that magic kingdom in the sky.
In the sky.
We will all be there together by and by.
This is the Quality News Network. The Dow Jones Industrials and the S&P 500 closed at record highs. We'll have the numbers coming up in our business segment. Health officials in the U.S. and Europe are searching for nearly 80 passengers from a transatlantic flight because they sat near a man with a dangerous form of tuberculosis. Those passengers need to be tested. The infected man is now quarantined. Health officials say he boarded several international flights even after he was advised not to fly because he could expose others to the disease. President Bush asked Congress to approve another $30 billion to help fight against AIDS in Africa. The money would be dispersed over a five-year period and would double what the U.S. now gives. The money would provide treatment for 2.5 million AIDS sufferers. The U.S. military reports that a Chinook helicopter has been shot down in southern Afghanistan, killing five soldiers. NATO forces say one of their helicopters also crashed in the southern part of the country, but gave no details. A purported Taliban spokesman phoned the Associated Press saying his group was responsible for bringing down that helicopter. In London, British negotiators are working on a strategy to win the release of five British civilians who were seized yesterday in Iraq. The hostages were taken out of the finance ministry office by gunmen dressed in police uniforms. U.S. forces in Iraq are also searching for the kidnapped men and have made several arrests. President Bush and Soviet President Vladimir Putin will meet in July. The meeting comes at a time when Soviet-American relations are said to be at their lowest point since the Cold War era. In Washington, President Bush officially announced he'd like former trade negotiator Robert Zelnick to replace former World Bank President Paul Wolfowitz. The appointment must still be endorsed by the bank's 24-member board of directors. Tropical Storm Barbara is the first tropical storm of the season, which officially begins June 1st. Barbara's off the coast of Mexico and is expected to make landfall in Acapulco in the next few days. Tropical Storm Alvin is the first in the eastern Pacific. Six people are dead after 3 days and four nights of flooding in central Texas. At least three of the deaths occurred when people were trapped on flooded roads. You're listening to the Quality News Network. We have Science and Business next.
Terry's Lounge at the Cypress Inn in downtown Carmel invites you to a great evening of your favorite foods, beverages, and live music Thursday through Saturday, featuring Dick Whittington and friends from 6 to 9:30. Terry's Lounge in the Cypress Inn features an appetizer-sized menu and our famous burger, salad, and fries. Afternoon tea, a great local tradition, is served from 1 to 4 p.m. daily by reservation. Sunday evenings are special as Richard Divnick entertains from 5 to 8 p.m. with classical renditions of pop, jazz, and classical music. Join the fun, food, and music at Terry's Lounge in the Cypress Inn, corner of Lincoln and 7th. In downtown Carmel.
Biologists in California say the two lost whales that made a trip 90 miles up the Sacramento Delta may now be back in the Pacific Ocean. They haven't been sighted today and likely slipped under the Golden Gate Bridge last night. Lake Okeechobee, America's second largest freshwater lake, has dropped to its lowest recorded level ever, endangering Florida's Everglades and the water supply for some 5 million people. Florida is currently suffering its worst drought in its history. Croatian scientists at the University of Zagreb are teaching honeybees to sniff out unexploded landmines. Areas of the former Yugoslavia were heavily mined during and after the Bosnian War. Thousands of those mines remain scattered throughout the region. The U.S. Supreme Court narrowly ruled workers suing employers for pay discrimination must do so within 180 days of the pay being set. The strict timetable applies even if the worker doesn't realize his salary is lower than others until much later. In May, consumer confidence surged forward, surprising analysts. Some economists say consumer optimism about the economy offset concerns about rising gas prices. Light sweet crude is trading at $63.43 a barrel. At the close of Wall Street, the Dow hit a new record. It was up 112 points at 13,633. The Nasdaq was up 21 points. And there's more news at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Laurel Chris.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Coming up on 6 minutes past, I'm all better now. No, I'm not, but I'll pretend. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is Head On for a Wednesday night. It's a prayer meeting here. And we're joined on the phone at this point in time by a man who I hope will become a new friend of the program, Joe Badgett, author of the upcoming text, Deer Hunting with Jesus. And I don't know how to even begin to describe something with a title like that, Joe, but welcome to the program. I'm so glad to make your acquaintance.
Well, thank you, Bob. I really appreciate it. And when I heard it was coming from West Virginia, I said, I'm doing that one. That's my people.
I'm so glad you decided to, because, yeah, it's your folks, and your folks are my folks, and we're all a bunch of crazy Scots-Irish, and we're just trying to get over it.
Well, we're also the hardest-working people in America, and you need to start getting a little respect for it.
Well, there is that as well. I first became aware of your writing when one of our listeners over in the chat room, a gentleman who goes by the name of Cossack, sent me a dispatch you had written from the Belizean coast.
Oh, yeah.
And I must admit, I was freezing my butt off here and was filled with just abject jealousy. But your observations, especially of redneck America, of which we are a proud part.
Yeah, I'm not ashamed of the name.
No, we can fix broken cars and make 70-year-old houses work out just fine, and we're amazing folks, but we have been led astray, have we not?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think we've been manipulated politically. You know, it's not anything that new, except I do believe that the current administration and the last couple waves of Republicans understood a couple things. Like, everybody says, oh, the Republicans were so organized at the grassroots level. You hear that from the liberals a lot. No, they had sense enough to collect church lists. Nobody had ever done that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
It was a little sleazy, but, you know.
Yeah. Oh, little. Voter caging and all that. But you know, I mean, my brother is a fundamentalist preacher over in Martinsburg, West Virginia.
Oh, dear me.
Church over there. And I could tell by watching, they were flattered to get the political attention in the first place. And the second place, most people really didn't understand the separation between church and state.
Well, in that particular arena, they're frequently told that it doesn't exist, that it's a misnomer, that it's just a handy little phrase that was taken from a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote and regenerated by Hugo Black, and that, you know, no, this is not, it's not really real. There's no separation.
Yeah, yeah. I try not to, you know, in the book, what I tried to do is come meet my people and then see what you think, you know. And of course, you know, being who I am, I can't keep my mouth shut in between. I got some opinions, too.
Right.
But a lot of it, you know, somebody asked me the other day, You know, are working people doing anything to help America? I said, no, America's got to do something to help working people. They've been neglected, you know, and if you feel like they're ignorant or you feel like they're ill-informed, you know, then it's your America too, you know.
And there's a and I don't mean any elitism by this, Joe, but it's somewhere along the way somebody, and obviously you're doing it, we're trying to do it, has an obligation to try to get some of the information out there, to try to counter some of the ignorance. And it's not willful ignorance, whether it's the media or what's being passed down from the pulpit. There's a big con job going on, isn't there?
I think so, but there always has been. It's just been effective lately.
Yeah, but what, you know, whether it's we've had the discussions about immigration and things like that, and I pointed out at one point, you know, all these it's one thing to have an illegal, so-called illegal immigration problem in a state that borders Mexico, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you have an illegal immigration problem in North Carolina?
Or in my hometown, right here, the town proper itself is 26,000 people. We've got 4,000 illegal aliens live here, almost all from Mexico, El Salvador, and so on. And that's the way that people that run the high end of business and industry around here like it. It's no darned accident.
No, and it has to do with, 10, 15 years ago?
My daddy's labor going down another dollar an hour if he were still alive.
Well, that's the truth,
wages,
Joe.
It's never been lower here compared to buying power.
And, 15, 20 years ago, there were right-wing or Republican, so-called conservative legislators howling about something called right to work.
Yep. Well, now, I mean, my state's partly famous for the Byrd machine, who invented the right-to-work law, Senator Harry Flood Byrd, you know.
Right.
And he actually started really early, we're looking at 30s and stuff, because he wanted the labor here cheap to pick apples. Here they grew a lot of apples then,
yeah,
on what could only be called apple plantations. And if they could keep everybody begging for a job, then he made more money on his apple.
Yeah,
and
darn straight.
His son was a senator. And I don't think political talent is necessarily hereditary, you know.
Yeah.
And they have, of course, the right to work law has just become so institutionalized now that.
And it's right to work in Virginia, in North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Tennessee, everywhere that you see this influx of south of the border cheap labor, just curiously happens to be a place that has an entrenched right to work culture.
Well, absolutely. It's a sacred thing here, even working men. See, that was one of the earliest misnamings of law, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
No child left behind and that sort of thing. But I was taking a friend here, he's from Russia, and he's American, but he's been in Russia quite a while teaching. And we drove down the street. I grew up here and partly over the West Virginia line on my grandparents' farm. We go back there every time my family would get too broke. And I drove down the street, and our town is 66% rentals now, all owned by about 12 people. It's a town with 10,000 residential buildings in it. And I drove down the street, two of the old streets we lived on, they were never good anyway. It was the place where white met black at the edges, you know, right in the seam down through town. And the people living in those houses, of course, many of them are dead and so on, used to own those houses.
Not anymore.
They bought them working at the mill.
And,
you know, and sad. It's really sad.
Yeah, welcome to the Bush economic miracle.
That's right. That's right.
And it's...
it's an ownership society, but...
Well, we've had one of those before, Joe. We've had one of those before, and there was a little dust-up back in 1860 fought over the ownership society.
Yeah, that's... yeah. Well, it's a lack of information here. It's also, I've been around this country enough to see it. My friend tells me it's now happening in Russia. But, you know, the belief in, here's these cheap Walmart goods. People feel like they're doing better than their daddy did because they got some new cheap slave labor clothes made in China and they got a new truck there, two payments behind them.
That was assembled in Mexico.
Yeah, you know. And they say, oh, we're doing better. You know, what? You know, because you got more debt than the last four generations of your family ever had. You know, no job security, no health care, and a few cheap trinkets and doodads and electronic junk. Well, the snow job worked pretty well.
Yeah, it's worked very well. What you know, the essay that you wrote or that prompted me to contact you was Redneck Liberation Theology.
Oh, that, yeah.
And in which you describe, among other things, your neighbor down the the neighbor down the road who thought he was doing okay, and everybody noticed the foreclosure notice published in the legal ad section of the newspaper. And you sort of, that's tough, and you don't say so much about it. But that's big. That's, you know, we're going from the American dream to the American nightmare,
oh,
are we not?
We have pages of them these days, of those boxes. Now, when I say, you know, I don't want, I always worry a little bit when people refer to the stuff I write from beliefs. A few years ago, well, I finally just started acting on it about 2 years ago. I'm 60 years old. You know, and I wanted to do better than I have done. I always joke and tell my wife, you know, I felt the devil's hairy hand around my ankle. I'm going to clean my act up and be a better world citizen. So I went down to Belize and found a village there. And for $3,000, you can build a man a home, you know. For $500, you can put a working woman in a restaurant business. You know, for $1,000, you can start a man in a construction company. These Garifuna people, they're black fishermen, and they're the underdogs of their nation. So I always try to make it clear that I don't go down there to lay in the sun. You know, this fat old guy.
I don't think anybody could hold it against you.
The proceeds from the book are all go entirely there. I live on $4,000 a year because I'm trying to talk and walk my talk, you know, and it's possible.
Well, bless your heart for it. I was reading the article and I put on a Jimmy Buffett song, but I don't think there's a crime in that.
Well, all I was saying is that you can go and make the world a better place, and everybody says, why didn't you go down to New Orleans? Because what goes down in New Orleans is a racket, and a man with $10,000 or $15,000 couldn't help America. You know, well, we can, but there's another way to do it. You know,
right.
It's political.
Right. But you know, but also while you were in Belize, Joe, I think you were able to put some. Oh boy, I'm going to sound like a real granola eater now. You put some psychic space between you and the stuff that you like to observe.
Well,
the stuff that matters.
Well, granola. I'm an old hippie too.
Okay.
And I left this town. I joined the Navy. Lied about my age. I was 15 and a half years old and went off to the Vietnam era. Just to get away, and I thought it was opportunity in my eyes, you know, but it was getting out of a small town. And when I got back, then I went through sort of a hippie stage, which I'm proud of. You know, I learned about a little bit about being free. I think we knew something back then that a lot of people don't know now. But it's made me on the left side of the political scale for the rest of my life.
Well, I don't see how it could help but, because you stepped to the outside and you looked back in, and I think you're continuing to do that. At least that's what I'm getting from the essays that you write. Even sitting there where you are,
I'm in Virginia right now.
Right, so that's what I mean. Even sitting there where you are, there's still a little aspect of, you know, you didn't get conned, you didn't get sucked in, you didn't buy the hokum, you didn't drink the Kool-Aid or rub the snake oil on.
I did for a while. I did for 15 years. See, I mean, I was the guy that quit high school, right, and got a GED in the Navy. And when I got out, by the time I was 20, I was married, and I had a 16-year-old wife, and by the time I was 21, I had a kid. And my first experience with college was to get the $210 a month from the GI Bill, and then the whole world opened up.
Yeah, and again, the GI Bill is not what it was.
No,
It's a come on. It's a Carney's card trick now.
Oh, I know. Do you think Lindy Ingram was ever really going to go to college?
I know.
I don't know if you've hit that chapter yet where she talks, you know. But if you never had a book in your house growing up, you know, and your daddy was a truck driver and your mama was a waitress, and you spent your time watching American Idol. There, I don't care how much you're in the Army, you're not going to walk out of there and go to a university. Probably not. That's the odds. And the big lie that anybody can become president, not when you're in a white culture. My argument in the book is much of white culture is ghettoized, too.
we just don't prefer not.
The difference is we don't wear the baggy shorts and the bling and the chain around our neck. We got a truck and a gun, but it's the same ghettoization. If you can't see outside the box that you're trapped in.
Yeah, and if the most you can hope for is to maybe tread water and stay even with mama and daddy, that's an abnegation of the American dream, isn't it, Joe?
I think so. I mean, I think every American probably had a different dream, but there was some commonalities that appealed to the whole darn world, and one of them was owning your own home. That was a pretty darn hard thing to do in the 18th century when this country was founded. I mean, an idea of boundless land and some yeoman sense of freedom, which I personally believe a warrior, as the Scots-Irish are, they did understand that certain surly aspects of freedom, you know, that are very good. Jim Webb writes about it in his book, you know, and those things are all gone. A man's home is his castle. My friend from Russia said, you know, in the city he lives in, 1 million people, every single person owns their home outright and has a DACA in the country, and they're bitching because they're not as rich as Americans.
They're watching too much TV, Joe.
Well, he said they don't get it, you know, that all this stuff has been taken away from working people who are at least 60% of the population, and I could make a good argument for 70.
So let me ask then, Joe. You know, this particular essay title, Redneck Liberation Theology, Why Are Leftists So Damn Afraid of God? This is our prayer meeting edition. Wednesday nights is prayer meeting here at Head On. So I have to ask you, do you see it as being part of any sort of liberal or progressive outreach to the working South? Does it have to clothe itself in the mantle of religion in similar fashion to what the right-wing religion industry's already done?
Well, I don't think urban liberals, I mean, what we have going on is it's almost urban versus rural in its cosmology. My editor, my publicist, and, you know, I mean, I'm a redneck boy. I never thought I'd have a damn publicist. An editor. They all grew up, you know, urbanites in New York, and they're strong liberals, and they're great Democrats. And I don't think they can do outreach. I don't think they understand us enough. I think we have to be, I'm doing a new one about trench liberals, you know, and leftnecks. There's people that can come from our own people. I've sat in enough bars and churches around here to know that we got plenty of darn smart people that can speak the language, you know.
Yeah.
And I personally have talked to hundreds and convinced them. Not, usually not, but I mean, you know, over the years. And we're not incapable of getting the point. But it's, I just don't think it's going to be like it used to be where, you know, the person that has a certain kind of urban liberal education and background, it's not going to be able to say it the right way, you know. And then when I say why are leftists afraid of God, that's more a symbolic way of saying it, you know. Well, there is a spiritual self, and most of all, there's moral self. That's what the next book is about, and it's sort of about redneck liberation in a way, except it's about the Americans starting to find the moral center they lost, you know, and. I don't know what to say beyond that. You know, I think mm-hmm. people should not be afraid of morality, and they should not be afraid of spirituality, and they should not be afraid of brotherhood. And those things are not the exclusive property of Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson or the Republican Party.
No, we were talking, me and that mouse in my pocket. I was talking last night with a gentleman from Media Matters for America, and we sort of verged onto that topic insofar as... we don't necessarily, you know, that survey that was done after the 2004 presidential election, and the media made such a hoo-ha out of it, where people said, you know, moral values were the reason that they voted for George Bush. Well, you know, moral values are also whether or not your neighbor gets to keep his house, or whether the guy comes with the rollback in the middle of the night and takes away his truck because he can't make enough money to take care of his family. Those are moral issues as well. And I think you're absolutely right. I think there's a reason that John Kerry never had a prayer south
never
of the Mason-Dixon line.
Neither is Hillary Clinton.
No, she doesn't.
But all the people up there at the publishing company are thinking, hell, Hillary's going to fix it all.
Well, I don't see it because I don't see, you know, I
said you couldn't have picked a more disliked woman in America by and large when it comes to voting.
Yeah, and that's not to say no woman can win.
No, not at all.
It's that woman can't win.
That woman can't win because she's perceived as ambitious, as cold. And they tell
Let's
she's not.
Uppity.
Well, you better show people.
Yeah, let's not forget Uppity, Joe. She's
uppity. Yeah.
That's
a good show.
Yeah. And the same thing with John Kerry. You know, he came to West Virginia, and we stood out in the hot sun at the airport in Beckley, and he came out and he talked to us about what America needs.
Yeah.
And a little bit later, he showed up at a rally on Labor Day where the UMWA gave him a hunting rifle.
Yeah, I saw that.
And he was about as believable with that hunting rifle in his hand, whether or not he hunted every day of his life. It didn't work.
No,
it didn't speak.
I didn't want to vote for Fred Munster.
No.
You know, he wasn't believable at all. But even beyond that, you know, I don't really, I really don't much like, and you know, I'm so far left, I got to send up smoke signals to say hello to the Communist Party. So I don't know what the hell you say, you know. But I don't like the easy explanations like framing and all that. But there is some truth. The culture wars, there ain't any culture wars. It's just people, you know. And when the liberal, the educated liberal mind, and I guess I'm an educated liberal, sort of, you know. I'm incorrigible, but I tried. You know?
Yeah.
But the thing is they love the terminology. And so we hear about culture wars. Yes, you can define it that way. And that's nice. And it's nice for the university crowd to talk about. And when I read about it, I'm fascinated. But it's not going to say hello to your brothers down here.
No, and there's a... You can't be afraid, and see that's why I got in touch with you, Joe. I felt like you and I were sort of resonating on the same at the same rate on the same string.
Brothers under the skin.
Exactly. You can't be afraid to walk into a bar, and you can't walk in there going, oh my God, they still allow smoking in this state. Oh,
right.
You can't be afraid to know a little bit of Bible, and it wouldn't hurt us.
You know, at the same time, they talk about culture wars. They won't acknowledge that the Bible then is part of the American culture.
Sure, it is.
They have it both ways.
No, you're absolutely right. So you know, I think it seems to me, Joe, that you are taking the fight where the fight's got to go, and that's a lot of what we're trying to do here. We've got a host on this network in Florida. We've got a host on this network two of us in West Virginia, and more, you know, more coming, more growing all the time. And we find I get emails from people saying, "My God, it's so nice to hear somebody coming from the South who's talking liberal common sense." So you know, I think there's a place for it, Joe, and I think you're
especially
doing something really
West
important.
Virginia, you know, I'm getting more. Out of West Virginia. In fact, my oldest son, he's 39 years old, and he just, he grew up, you know, I moved around a lot when I was young, looking for work and stuff with the wife and kid, learning to be a writer and all that. He moved back, I mean, he moved over to West Virginia, and he's happy. He says, you know, you won't believe what's starting to happen in this state. You know, it's just somebody's got to say it out loud in the South, and he's right.
Yeah.
You know, and you got to reach some people, like you say, you know, with a media network of its own, and but he said it's here, you know.
And the biggest part of it is letting folks know that they're not alone.
Right.
Because one of the best tricks that the other side has done is to create this sense of the isolated liberal, as if we were some sort of endangered species like the snail darter.
Yeah. Well, you know, too. I always tell people, you know, when I'm dealing with people, you know, from northern urban areas or the West Coast, I lived out there for 14 years and I loved it, and it's a good place to live in most cases. And the average person from the the West Coast in California is no more zany and kooky and spacey than the stereotypes, you know, that we have of New Yorkers, you know. I mean, most people there work pretty darn hard for a living. But the stereotyping has just gotten entirely out of hand, and I feel like we allowed the Republicans to own all the words like values. If anybody's got a claim to values, it's at least the first half of the Democratic Party's history.
Sure it is.
But we let them claim those
the
words.
The 40-hour work week. That's a human value, the 40-hour work week, because that enables things like family togetherness, family cohesiveness, the child labor laws. You know, yeah. We were responsible for that too, Joe.
But see, you know, they just claimed the word without defining it. And anyway, they say, why do the people go to church so much there? You know, church attendance now is no higher than it was in 1820. One-third of Americans have always been pretty darn religious. You know how many born-again presidents we've had? But the difference is that, to me, when I looked around at my hometown when I came back, is the institutions, when they looked around at the institutions, public and social and civic, what door was open to them? The church.
Sure.
They could take their kids. There was bingo night. There was camps. There was marriage counseling. You know, what community was left? The church. You know, and there they could be among their own kind of people. But one of the big lies is that they're homogenous. They're not homogeneous. You know, if I go to a big praise temple here, you got two or three guys that run it, and they're politically active. You got about eight or nine elders, the inner church, a minister friend of mine calls it, that are activists. You got the front row that are the main fans. But you get back in that back third, and they haven't even been baptized.
No, they're there just to be reminded, I think, Joe, that they are not utterly isolated in this world.
And it's traditional. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
No, well, here's one good thing. It can't, and when you raise a kid, you have to expose them to the church. But if you sit back there and you get to know them, you find out that one-third of this great body of people that everybody is painting as being totally homogeneous is not at all homogeneous. You know?
Yeah.
And those are the guys you talk to.
Well, exactly.
Fred Clarkson wrote Eternal Hostility, and he was the first guy to start laying it out, you know, about this battle between that political battle that was coming up. And he said, the first thing you got to learn is who you can talk to, and that's that whole back half of the church.
Acrobaptist.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, I describe myself to the world as a recovering Southern Baptist. I know exactly what you're talking about there. I know those people, and I know, you know, what it's like to move into a town where you don't know anybody.
Yep.
Well, you know, there's an open door at the church. You know, you can't just move into the neighborhood and join the JCs or the Civitan.
Right.
But you can always you can find a church, because every one of them's got a welcome sinner sign sitting outside.
Well, and the other thing too is it's a community of working people. Everybody's been convinced that they're middle class, and really most of America is working class, but doesn't know it because they sell job instead of citizens. We're consumers now, and for instance, if the man tells you how many hours you'll work, what you'll get paid, what benefits you get, how much sick leave you get, if any, when you can take your vacation off, and when you can be let go because he doesn't need you anymore, that's called working class.
Yeah.
But the guy in the white technician's uniform down at the hospital doesn't see himself as working class.
No, he's a professional.
And the woman wearing the fake costume jewelry at some boutique that's making $8 an hour doesn't see herself as working class. And even medical technicians and people who went, you know, to some degree of training, I mean, they don't think they're working class because they don't have a blue denim shirt on and walking out of a mine wiping coal dust out of their eyes. Well, they got the world's changed. See, the traditional working class that people have in their mind, of course, it's a media image just like everything else. You know, those people walking that hospital floor at night, they better start seeing they are too. They're not middle class just because your car's shiny. You know?
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, Joe, I tell you what, I've really enjoyed our conversation. I know you're going to get awful busy here in a very short period of time, but I hope maybe somewhere along the way you can find time to come back and we can chat some more.
Well, I would love to, because anything out of West Virginia that I'm a fan of, and excuse me if I rattle on.
No, I love the rattling, man.
I drank a little bit of coffee here. I said, I'm getting worked up for this one. We're talking in the great state of West Virginia.
Well, I tell you what, any time, I am serious, any time that the burr gets under your saddle, please consider that there's an open door and an open line for you here. I love the way you write. I love the way you think, and I think there's a whole lot there's a whole lot more that need to hear what you're saying. I hope they'll hear it in the upcoming book.
There's been some big surprises about that book, because the reason I never wanted to even write a book. I mean, they called me. I didn't call them, and I'm not bragging. I'm just saying, I don't want to go through a divorce. I've watched a lot of writers do books.
Yeah.
And but the thing of it was, they said, oh, well, the market is the urban liberal. And
is this a travel log
but you
from
know
the?
What? I get hundreds and hundreds of emails a week from people. You know, they might be school teachers, they might be supervisors at the plant, they might be this or that or the other, but the majority of emails I get are from people that do not have a college education. Only 20% of America gets a degree. And so, in their high and mighty judgments about who the audience is going to be, the big shock has been there's a hell of a lot of people that still know how to think in this country.
Sure.
So I've been absolutely deeply moved and humbled, you know, by the response that's come from, you know, people that are taking it up the shorts and say, yep, that's the truth.
And who have gotten their education the hard way.
And maybe gotten none at all. I mean, there's so many self-educated people in this country, there's no acknowledgement of it. I had no idea that there were so many literate people, educated themselves from working class families with a high school education.
Sure.
You know, and went on and read things and do things and think.
Well,
I could show you my emails.
I'd love to see them. There was a book that came out, I guess maybe a year or so ago, the title of which was Whistling Past Dixie. I don't know if you're familiar with it or not, but the thesis of it, Joe, is that in order to build a Democratic majority in this country, Democrats need to forget about Alabama and Virginia and North Carolina and Tennessee and Kentucky. Just forget about them, because you know, that's high-hanging fruit and it's going to be too much work to do.
Yeah.
If we're and you know what, maybe he's right. If we're willing to just forego the notion of a republic and one nation under God and or you know, whatever you want to call it, if we're willing to forego that and just balkanize an entire segment of the country and cede that battleground to the other side and say that those people aren't worth it, then that guy's right. But if you're right and if I'm right, then that is where we take the fight.
Yeah. Yep. You know, I'll tell you another thing, too, and I don't want to drag it on too long here.
All the time you want,
Joe. These values that these people hold at core, if somebody wants to get down and talk about values, and I've done it in some gritty darn venues, there are the things of a decent wage, you know, a decent opportunity in life, and so on. These values aren't just white and Scots-Irish. The reason the book's getting so much publicity is because nobody thought white people could be oppressed, right?
Mm-hmm.
The big liberal myth that the white man is always the oppressor. Well, I'll tell you, when I talked to these Hispanics, I organized a renter's union, you know, because of what was going on here, no housing inspections, and all the things you get away with in the South. And I found out, the thread of common basic values is common to working black men, working white men, and new immigrants. You know, a chance, an opportunity, and a little bit of justice and security.
And a willingness to work like a dog.
Yeah.
In exchange for just
what?
A little bit of that.
That used to be the values of the Democratic Party, those three things. They could still have all those people, you know, before the Westchester Country Club decided it was better to get yuppies in 401Ks.
Yeah, there's so much truth in that. I was recently down in Alabama, Joe. That's where I was born and raised. All my family's from here. My dad passed away a few months ago, and I'm trying to handle his estate and take care of his place. Mm-hmm. I went down there to look after a couple of things and pick up another truckload of stuff and bring it back. And within, 30, 45 minutes of having pulled into the driveway, two different neighbors had come up and said, you know, just wanted to let you know we're keeping an eye on the place while you're gone. And I can think of a lot of places in the United States where that wouldn't happen. There's a lot of places in the United States now, Joe, where you can live 50 feet from somebody for 25 years and never know who they are.
Yep.
The
whole big band around D.C. is like that. Now, I lived out in Eugene, Oregon, the same way. I lived 10 years in a house there. Met my neighbors on each side about four times.
Yeah. Before I left, the 93-year-old neighbor lady brought me a sweet potato pie. To have on the way home. She said, you know, I've seen you out there working so hard in the yard and cleaning up and everything. I wanted you to have something special. And by God, this wasn't wasn't a sweet potato pie in any Ritz pie crust either. This had been rolled out, had a little bit of fat in it, and had drops of ice cold water sprinkled in the flour, rolled out and put in a pan, and the filling put in it and baked for me. I got tears
God,
in my eyes.
I know you, brother. You do know the truth, don't you?
Those people, daggummit, Joe, those people are worth fighting for.
Yes, absolutely.
And bless her heart, this particular neighbor lady wouldn't deign to set her foot in the same tracks that a Democrat had walked in, because she has been hammered by a singular message that we have no values, that we're godless, that we're atheists, that we're that we want to take the in God we trust off
well,
the money.
And a real quick example of something.
Yeah,
that we know that, and I don't have a whole lot of faith that the Democratic Party is going to pull it out either. You know, but we are the. Liberalism is inclusiveness. If it's nothing else, it's inclusiveness. The divisiveness that has come with ethnic and identity issues and sexual preferences and gender issues and all that work against us when here it was an election year, and what did they make a big issue? Gay marriage. Jesus Christ, let us all get free first.
Well, let us.
I mean, what kind of choice? Who would have made a choice like that if you knew where America was?
Well, but we got conned on that one too, Joe, because that was
politically
that was a creature of the right. I mean, the memos are out there. You know, emphasize gay marriage, emphasize the big rocks in courthouses and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. We've done a lousy job of equating. Of letting them talk about gay rights when we should be talking about human rights.
Exactly, and wages, and what we're going to do when the oil runs out, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of like my mother. I have an elderly mother in a nursing home, and she's from that, you know, that previous generation, and we were talking about stuff that was on TV, you know, about gay marriage, and she says, well, honey, I ain't quite sure what they do. Might not be healthy, though, huh? You know, I mean, these are people who never even think about it, you know, but they wave it around like a bloody shirt. You know what I mean? She's
yeah.
never thought about gays in her life.
Never met a communist either, but, you know, there are people out there who are just sure that, you know, that people like you and me are trying to advocate for the workers' paradise.
No,
when we're not, we just.
No, I'm saying a whole lot of bad stuff is coming down the road. The cheap oil fiesta is going to be over, you know. And then what are we going to do, man? If we're not pulling together now, what's going to happen? You know, when all this cheap energy, they think the price of gas is bad. You know, in Belize it's $12 a gallon.
Yeah.
But people don't. They ride bicycles and. It's like your sweet tater pie, you know, the neighbors, I go away, I don't own the house there. I built the place there, put it on somebody else's property, and said, you rent it out, and if I come back, and I send them $100 a month, 12 months a year, anyway, they look out for me, all my stuff, you know what I mean, my guitar and the things I've left down there, nothing's going to happen, you know, they're neighbors, and
mm-hmm.
that's what I'm trying to show in some of the next things that I'm writing. What real community felt like, and people like you and me, we still remember it.
And if we don't...
We may be the last generation if it keeps up.
It could very well be. And if we don't rebuild it, when those times come that you are talking about, Joe, there is going to be hell to pay.
Oh, I know.
You know, we've got to find our way back to where neighbors talk. You know, part of what we do here is dedicated... We call it, you know... and I think we earn our stripes. We call what we do here conversation radio. This isn't talk radio. This isn't host-driven. This is about dialogue. It's about process. It's about discussion. It's about looking for answers, and it's about sitting on a front porch and talking amongst yourselves till you can, you know, because you can solve a lot of problems that way. It's not just idle chatter.
Yeah, and not a totally controlled conversation. Yeah.
Right.
I never thought I would be the fat old uncle sitting on the porch running my mouth this mad. I had an uncle had political opinions. Well, you know, I'm proud to be in his shadow, you know. And like you say, it is like a porch conversation. It can go where it goes. The person might be behemoth and it might be relaxed, you know, but it sure beats the silly managed promotion of most of this interview stuff.
No, you're going to be doing some of that.
I'm doing 200 basically scripted interviews.
You get the little sheet with the book that says, here are the questions to ask Joe.
I had to write the questions and the answers.
Oh, God.
And then I had to dumb them down twice.
Oh, Lordy, I tell you.
And I didn't want to do that. Yeah. You know, I signed a contract and I took a man's money, and so I did it.
Yeah, sure you did. Well, but, yeah. I want this to work out for you. I want the message to get out there. If there's anything we can do to help beyond encouraging people to buy the book and talk and know your neighbors, talk to the folks, start an American dialogue, because that seems to be where you're going to. If there's anything we can do to help, Joe, please consider
it's the same here.
A new friend.
Same here. If there's anything I can do, I mean, they tell me that, I'll tell you, I had a couple touching moments here this last month. You know, when Studs Terkel wrote that blazing endorsement for it to put on the cover, you know, about the voice of our people, I was sitting there at the computer with tears in my eyes, because there was a man who's been working in America all his life, and he was my hero. I mean, he's been my hero since I was 20 years old.
And Mark Crispin Miller comes out and says, you write like an avenging angel.
Yeah, well, you know, and you would understand. Each time something like that happens, you know, I'm seriously choked up, because I never thought I would see something like this happen. And now Random House is putting it up for a National Book Award, you know.
Jiminy.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't mean it'll win it, because I know what kinds of judges, but it doesn't matter. It's the idea of our journey from where we are, from where you are. I mean, it sounds like your background was much like mine.
Coal miners.
To come so far in America has been a gift. I mean, it has been a gift. I worked for every damn inch of it. But can't throw it out. You can't throw out the opportunity. You know, the opportunity to be free and to speak and have dialogue, like you said, that porch, the American porch.
Well, you know, when somebody like Howard Zinn says that you evoke working class America like no one else, that would bring tears to my eyes.
It did. It did. You know, and Sherman Alexie, who wrote, it's not so popular out here, but he won a National Book Award. I lived on an Indian reservation in Idaho. I built a cabin and I plowed with horses. I wanted to just escape America, right? So I did this for about 7 years in northern Idaho. Sherman Alexie is a young, well, he's not so young, he's 50, but he felt young to me. And he lived up there on that reservation, and I didn't know it. And he wrote an endorsement for the book. And then he called me and he said, you know, I used to come in the bar you tended and drag my daddy out. You know, and I remember, oh my God, that's Mr. Alexie's son. And he said, it's the same America. It's the same America for Indians, and it's the same America for working poor white men. You know, he said, and he had been waiting for a white man, you know, to write about the oppression of working white people. And so once more, you know, I was so damn emotional. I mean, my God, this guy whose books I admire, you know, for telling the truth, books like Reservation Blues and Lone Ranger and Tonto Fist Fight in Heaven, and what really did is he made it so soulfully real what reservation life was. And then to find out that you had helped him carry his daddy out many nights, see, I didn't remember because it was so many years ago.
Yeah, that.
So these kind of things that have come accompanying it have just shocked you when you come from a town like this. You say, wow, what a large country, what a journey an American can be.
What a large country, what a journey, and what a tiny, tiny place in many ways as well.
Yeah, oh yeah, and yet it's tight.
Well, I tell you what, we could go on like this for the rest of the night. You know, but I know you're busy, and I know you keep at it, and those 200 interviews you got coming up, man, that's going to take some starch. I mean, you'll have some saddle sores when you're done with that, Joe. But you know, I love this idea of what did I see here? Bourbon fueled prose.
It's a long tradition.
White hot bourbon fueled prose. I can't imagine anybody writing that about something that was written by one of those guys at the Westchester Country Club you were talking about.
Well, you know what? As Southerners, you know, we have a culture that came for an awful long time without any operas, without any movie, without any string quartets and all this, and telling a story was entertainment in a hell of a lot of cabin van plantation parlors. And your ability to tell a story, we have a story gene, you and me and just about anybody I've ever met in West Virginia, you know.
Yep.
Because social acceptance was part of it was based on a rural culture that you had to be able to tell a good story, and often you were your own victim in it for the humor's sake. So that's been a lucky gift, because coming from the South enables you to write, to tell a story, and just instead of just report facts.
It's got to be interesting. You know, there's that old saying about the English came and built a house, the Germans came and built a barn, the Scots came and built a still. these things fall into place, and again, I don't know how much of the urbane, sophisticated liberals actually understand that. You know, a trip to East Aboga, Alabama, is as mystifying as a trip to the Congo, and I don't mean any racial overtones to that. I mean,
nope.
It's every bit as foreign. And to have somebody offer you the bottle with the cork out, and no glass,
yep,
is some level of heresy. But if you sit back and you take a swig, Joe,
yeah,
and you start to talking and you feel that burn in your belly, and you hear the way that board creaks under the rocker of the chair,
that's right.
And you pick up the inherent rhythms, and you start talking about the real problems that face real working people. Then the next thing you know, it's going to play a little bit more hollow the next time that guy with the perfectly manicured hands and the no hair out of place haircut comes on the TV and says, "I've got family values."
Right.
It's going to be a little harder,
you know,
to run the con.
John Edwards got $55,000 for a speech on poverty.
God. I know.
So, I mean, you know, it's, some of us can, you read a line like that, and how can that pass anybody? Those two words, and that number and that word in the same sentence in a newspaper. And nobody was shooting him down.
Well, can I ask you one last hard question,
sure,
then, Joe? You mentioned John Edwards there, and we talked a little bit about Hillary. Do you have a person who is there a person on the Democratic side of what's going to happen in 2008 that has captured your fancy in any way?
Oh yeah, yeah, lots of them, but nobody ever heard of him. Jim Webb's the only one anybody ever heard of. Oh man, a lot of people don't like him. You know, for liberal, he's a little bit military. You know, well, we come from a fighting line of people, and you know, I told him I didn't like your book. I think he emphasized the fighting too much. We got a lot of other good stuff about us, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, but you know, if we get along, and but by golly, you know, when he understands the symbolism, you know, that wearing those boots, it's not just a stunt. He's got a son in Iraq. When a man tells the president off on television, you know, the guy says, "How's your son?" He'll be doing a lot better when you get us out of Iraq. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, the guy is got that nice wild streak. I really like him. There's many things I'd done. I don't know what he'd be like as the president. I know he wouldn't be the most stupid warlike president we had, but we're not going to get anybody that's going to have all the qualities.
Well,
compromise and agreement. But it's the first one I've ever seen. Him and a couple other people that are local ones, you know, that stand up and just say it.
Well, we're in a profound state of frustration here, the folks that share their time to hang out and listen to me prattle on, Joe. We're in a profound state of frustration because, you know, Hillary doesn't look like it. Bless his heart, Barack Obama doesn't look like it.
No.
You'd like to say maybe John Edwards, but again, you know, there's a lot of off-putting stuff there.
Yeah, see, the thing, too, with John Edwards, I mean, I'm really lucky that a lot of people... I'm only 85 miles from D.C. It was the sticks when I was growing up here, and now it's the way exurbs or something.
Yeah.
And so they tell me things, you know, I mean, people you know that are in the government and so on. And the thing is that John Edwards has the right roots, but is suckered in by some yuppie thing. They said if you meet his people, you know, you're going to meet some people with Bible hair.
he's been consulted, hadn't he?
But he's afraid for anybody to see it. And the other thing is, of course, he is a lawyer. That's two strikes right there.
Yeah.
Seriously, though, they said that the thing about John Edwards is that he's pretty much sucked into the Westchester Country Club thing when he doesn't have to be. But if he privately, you know, he does get it.
Well, I think he does. And the lawyering that he has done, Joe, to me indicates that he does.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
You know, the other side calls him an ambulance chaser. But, you know, when a guy takes a case on of a child who literally got sucked down a drain hole,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's a guy fighting on the side of the angels,
yeah,
as far as I'm concerned.
Say, and they say he's image stuff is it bowls him over too much. You know, hell, look what it did to John Kerry when you let other people control your image.
Well, look what it did to Al Gore. I mean, here's a personal, a completely personable human being,
yes.
who got imaged to death in 2000.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, there's George Bush running around the country mispronouncing the entire language, and people think it's because he's a good old boy. It's not. It's because he's a moron.
I know. Well, you know, just about anybody they got could sit on their hands, and if it, any Democrat, and get elected and sit on their hands and not do any more damage and look pretty damn good to me.
Well, yeah, I get some of that. I just wonder.
I'm only half joking.
I understand what you're saying completely. You know, we've had Dennis Kucinich on this program, and why Dennis doesn't get more attention from the populist, from the people who have a populist turn, is beyond me. Because
he's my absolute favorite candidate. He consistently is, and I don't know what you do about it.
You know? I don't either. I honestly, honest to God, I don't. There were better answers in the debate coming from him. I just about wept. I don't know if you watched that debate, that so-called debate, where they asked him, asked the rest of the field if anybody would join with him in his bill of impeachment against Dick Cheney, and all those hands just hung there by their sides, and Hillary looked at the moderator like, well, you know, if looks could kill, the poor dude would have gone away in a basket. It was grieving. It was grievous to see that happen, Joe, because that means that there's an entire field of political candidates on the Democratic side who are more obsessed with their quest for personal power than any sort of dedication to
a class. They are a political class, the same as the old Communist Party had a political class. There's one party in America, and it's called the Party of Business, and it has two sides, the Democrat side of the coin and the Republican side of the coin.
So do you just sit it out, Joe?
No, I don't think so, but what are you going to do? You know, I mean, you got to slap some people around, I guess. You know, I just don't know, I mean, because they've sold out. The Democrats, you know, all we're offered is two parties, you know, and you know, it's edged closer and closer to a more and more conservative values. I don't know. I mean, it, you know, if Kucinich is possible, I'll write him in.
Yeah.
But, you know, John Edwards is not a bad man.
No, and everybody's sort of sitting back saying, you know, well, Al Gore could do it.
Al Gore could do it with one hand behind him.
Because I think he's learned the lessons of the handlers. There's not going to, you know, Bob Schrum is not going to run his campaign.
Good.
You know, and speaking of books, that guy's got one.
Well, Jim Webb darn near didn't win in Virginia, and you know, this state is getting more and more liberal as people move down from up north. And I had a friend, he's the head of the Green Party here. Well, people are quite surprised to know there are Christian Greens.
Mm-hmm.
You know. They care about the environment, they're Christians, and they're green. And we got them here, and they've got them in other states, too. Well, everybody was kind of shocked. But anyway, when it came down to the wire, and for the last couple weeks, there was Webb and his Republican opponent, you know, 1 point apart, weeks on end, and the Greens had 2.5% of the vote.
Yeah.
And we always joke about how the Greens, you know, save Jim Webb. I mean, it's a story you'll never read about. Midnight conversations, and Jim saying, "I can't even do anything with these guys that handle me and all this," you know. But finally, it's it comes down to be one of our better victories here had to do with a bunch of unknown Christian Greens, and of course, when that candidate threw their vote to Jim Webb, they lost 1.5%, but all they needed was that 1%.
That was enough to take it over the top.
These are stories that, you know, why don't we hear about this in the news?
Well, I think it goes back to what you said, Joe. This is about the management of what. This is about managing what working stiffs get to hear, because you know they've maybe got 30 minutes, an hour tops a night over the over dinner with corporate over the air news coming at them.
Yep.
God knows they might be watching Fox, at which point you just go, well, Jesus, it's over.
I don't think they watch as much news as everybody says either.
Probably not.
I don't know anybody that watches Fox News in roughly around here, unless there's a big thing going on, you know, something big. And I go, well, I wonder how much of this is smoke and mirrors. Well, I mean, Fox, it offers a lot of things that people in my class like. But at the same time, I was trying to think, up and down the streets and down the block there, I don't know anybody goes home and watches Fox News, right?
No, not at all.
I'm wondering how much smoke and mirrors is going on there.
Well, you know, we've talked about ending the war, Joe, and I've put out there time after time after time that, you know, we can have a million people in Washington, D.C. on a Saturday yelling in unison, end the war now, and they're all gone on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as that persists, it doesn't matter if you've got 10 million people there on Saturday. If they're gone on Sunday, it don't matter. And
well, you know, when the women had their big national thing there about a year and a half ago or whatever, it had 250,000 women came to town. You know what the Washington Post had about it? They had a story about the traffic jam it caused.
Not surprising. And the point that I keep trying to make out of this, Joe, is that guys, you know, the guy who earns his living changing oil down at the Jiffy Lube might be able, and he's politically astute or whatever. He's part of that group of Americans that you so reverence. He may be able to show up in D.C. for a demonstration on a Saturday.
I live close to D.C. The first demonstration I ever went to was as soon as I got the heck out of the Navy. I started going to demonstrations against the Vietnam War, and I don't know if they work anymore down there. I mean, you could have the whole world turn up in D.C., and it's had so many, and it's so immune, and it's with its free speech zones, and it's all this stuff.
God,
and you
yeah.
can get a permit. If you don't get any news coverage, it doesn't mean much.
And there's not going to be any coverage unless they're there Saturday, Sunday, Monday. But again, the dude who changes
like
oil for a living
campaign. They sat there for months on the mall until somebody had to pay attention.
But we live in the MasterCard culture now, Joe.
Yep.
And if you're not back at work on Monday, you're going to lose the house.
Yep.
You're going to lose the expensive jewjaws of your existence that somehow define your sense of what you described earlier as thinking that you're middle class.
Well, what it is a combination mall and gulag.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And
you know, I'll tell you, I do believe, and because most people, even, you know, I mean, both sides of the, you know, the average Republican's not as different as the average working man, as people think. You know, he's misled, even the traditional one, you know, but we have a lot more in common than we think. You know what would really hurt?
What's that?
Somebody didn't pay taxes for one day.
Well,
the whole house of cards would come down if there was even 2% of the United States that says, no more, I'm not paying any more for any of it. And now that sounds pretty radical, and it sounds like you could never organize it, but it's going to be very interesting how people express their anger when we do hit things like peak oil.
And when we're no longer able to do the Walmart shopping because every last decent job is gone from this country, it's not going to be a tax revolt. It's going to be a tax necessity.
Hey, I heard a terrifying thing from an economist the other day about globalization. I couldn't believe it. He said when Henry Ford invented, you know, the motor car, he needed his workers as customers to buy.
Yeah.
So he gave them a raise. So he could sell at least that many thousands of them by the time it was over, and millions. He said, and so workers were necessary as consumers. He said, the polarization of wealth has now so far reached the tipping point that the wealthier around the world, I mean, this is not the wealthiest. We don't have the most wealthy people, by the way. I mean, they're all over the planet, and they leverage capital from the capital cities and the banking centers of the world. constitute enough of a market that you don't really, at some point, you probably won't need the Walmarts and you won't need the Radio Shacks or anything like that, because when you have that much money, you know, polarized at that end in 5, 10, 15% of the world that can pay $300,000 for a car, the advantage is you don't have to make as many, you don't have to ship it as far, you don't have to do as much production. That leaves everybody else working darn cheap, you know, because they're not even necessary as consumers anymore. And I work down in a third world country where they sell them water to drink, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, basics of life in many, many ways, you know. And it can come to it in this country, you know, where the basics will be what you're struggling for instead of the symbols.
Yeah, where you're making...
It can happen. I mean, I said, how can this be? How can they have... How can a small group of people have so much money that they constitute the entire market and therefore you don't need the millions to buy anything? And he was showing me, it's if all the money is there, that's where you do it. I had no idea. I had no idea that this polarization is global.
Oh, when Halliburton packs up bag and baggage and heads for Dubai, you know the fix is in.
Yeah. Nobody ever heard, you know, I mean, the wealthiest men in the world, you know, they have Mexican names, they have Arab names, they have African names, and French and German and all that.
And they all have one thing
really
in common.
I'm aware that the elite, this thing is not just here, it's everywhere.
No, but they all have one thing in common, Joe. They don't give a tinker's damn about the guy who's busting his ass 6-7 days a week at one or two or three jobs.
They don't even see the guy.
No, he doesn't exist. She doesn't exist to them.
Right.
Because it's not like they're going to go into a truck stop or pull into that Jiffy Lube. They've got an entire separate layer of people who will go and do that for them.
Right. Two or three layers.
Yeah, that's the truth, and we're talking there about a servant class.
I'll tell you what, I wonder, you line in candidates up and you say, how many of you know what Jiffy Lube, you know?
Yeah, it's
ever been in one.
Yeah, it's
I'd say John Edwards might be the only one.
it's Pappy Bush at the grocery store in 1992.
Yeah.
What's this barcode scanner thingy? My, isn't this curious?
Isn't this wonderful? You got. And I've read something by Paul Krasner was writing about it at the time. He says, is it any wonder the Japs are beating us? I don't mean that racially.
No.
You got a leader who doesn't even know what a scanner is, and we're heading into the age where computer domination of everything, and this is our president.
And the guy who's running the country now probably doesn't know what a gallon of gasoline is going for.
Oh, I'm sure he doesn't. You know?
Yeah.
Somebody was telling me.
But it's not just him.
Crawford, there's like an 8,000-gallon storage tank or something.
Yeah, there's a bunch of people who don't know what the price of gasoline is in the United States. Most of them are in the Congress.
Yeah. That's the truth. You ever lived around D.C.? Man, it is an education. Man, I watched when they built the Rayburn Building. I'm so old I can remember that. And that was really going to, you know, they really needed a lot of expansion. The Senate office building was too old and decrepit and all this. So they had all these offices, hundreds of offices, and they had bronze doors. And the bronze doors had eagles, and they had the history of the United States on it, right? And somebody complained that the louvers at the bottom that let the air in, people might hear the conversation, and they melted down all those bronze doors. And that was then.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at now, up the street, there's a guy that's a multimillionaire because he builds heliports, you know, on private estates out here of big Republican contributors, right? And all this is paid for with Homeland Security money because it's supposed to be the Continuation of Government Act. And so they go in and they build them long, historic-looking buildings that'll sleep 24 people and galley kitchens, pay them $4,000 a month for maintenance. Put in special communications, high-speed cables like we don't even have. Well, these guys were the big backers, and so the continuation of government thing is basically if there was ever a war or a national disaster or a terrorist event, they would disperse the government and send them out to these places. And all it was payback, you know, for the big cat contributors. Now, Now, the crazy thing about it is this guy became a millionaire simply by being a contractor because they had a big meeting in Crystal City, and they invited all these guys who had been faithful supporters, and they went into the contracting business, and they're still spending Homeland Security money out there making big
holes. Oh, there's a boatload of new millionaires out of the bungled Katrina recovery alone.
Yeah. Well, you see how they paid them back? They made their estates bigger and fancier and richer.
Yeah, exactly. And meanwhile, we sit around and we I'll be damned if canned corn's done gone up again.
I've told people about that, and they go, they're unmoved. And I go, they say, well, you know, government's all crooked.
Hasn't that been the message out of the Republican Party, Joe, for the last, 40 years? That government, I saw a quote from Tom DeLay in an article today. I mentioned it earlier on the air before our conversation, where he was talking about Newt Gingrich, and he said, government is the problem. You know, we have been through a history, Joe, where government was responsive to the needs of the people, where government was a solution, government was a way out, government was a way up, government was an equalizer, and in the short period of time that the people like Grover Norquist have had the public's ear, he's managed, and largely because, again, going back to the origin of this conversation, we have seeded the debate. The Grover Norquists of the world have succeeded in teaching America to hate the government that belongs to them.
Exactly. Well, you know, the thing too is, see, there is an anti authority streak in Americans, and we can thank the Scots-Irish for that too. They're not the only ones. They carry the gene, you know, when they'd marry anything that walked. I mean, their values went everywhere, and God love them. I'm glad we have it, the surly love of freedom. But the dislike of authority is a very, very American thing. It's down there in the bottom of people that you just wouldn't even believe it's there. It's not at the Westchester Country Club, but it's a distrust of authority. And Norquist knew how to use that. And those Reagan guys, you know, big government, you know.
We were going to get government off your back.
Communist-like thing, you know. And that plays well.
And it gets, it's easy, too, Joe, because it gets absorbed, it gets passed around. And you can, and you know, government is far away, and the news about government's usually not good. And so it's easier to look at, oh well, government's my problem. It's not the fact that I've got a right to work law here that is making me auction my labor off in a downward sleazy downward spiral race to the bottom. That's
well,
not the problem. It's government
to do it.
Yeah. It,
did you see that thing in Harper's about they had the nerve to take on the question of what if we became a totalist state? What if the military took over Washington, D.C.? Did you see that issue?
No, I didn't.
Well, they brought in some great retired Pentagon generals. They brought in some great old retired senators and media people. And they said, well, you know, it's a big, sprawling country. And for most people, if tanks went down the street in Washington, D.C. tomorrow and the Pentagon took over, you know, the government, for most people, it would be something that happened on television in D.C. Now, I know that they were joking a little bit, but that's the truth. That's the disconnect. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They'd see it, and some people would be outraged, and of course, we'd be out there. We'd probably be armed by then. But the point of it was is that government isn't real until election time to 99% of the people. You know, you and I happen to be particularly vocal and particularly active, but for most people, government is something that happens on television.
And it's something that happens on television to the point of nausea, so that by the time Election Day rolls around, we've had so many 30-second attack ads that we just want it to be over, and we'll just stay home, turn the TV off, it'll just end.
Yeah, a fellow too the other day, I thought it was pretty observant. He was a German guy, and he said, "Well, from what I see, I don't see how anybody would see any direct result of their vote on their lives."
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting because he could observe that. He says, you know, you don't see things being done for people very directly and obviously by the government like you do in certain other countries that are more socialized.
You see, it's a deliberate attempt, Joe, to keep government from being responsive. You know, we were preached the sermon about how government is the problem and government can't accomplish anything and it all has to be done by the private sector and government will fail no matter what it does. And bang, Katrina hits. And look, it, government failed, just like they told us it would.
Yeah, because they live in an isolated consumerhood.
Yeah, and because they meant for it to fail. You know, look at the privatization of our military.
Oh, I know, I know.
What, 50,000 gun-toting so-called private contractors? You know, come on, Joe, they're mercenaries, okay?
And that's just the ones carrying guns.
Right.
Not the ones doing a $100 bag of laundry.
And a five-star general can stand there and scream himself blue in the face at one of those mercenaries, and the mercenary can thumb his nose at him and tell him to bugger off.
Oh, I know. Well, you know, I saw something in Italy. I went to a Communist Party rally in Italy a while back, and because I was working for a magazine where I had to travel. They had international editions, and so my wife and I, in our 50s for the first time, got to go and see the world, you know, to the degree that business travel as an editor would let me do. And so they're in election time in Italy, and so I went to all three parties. Their elections only last a couple of weeks, and so they have these big rallies for each one. And I went to the Communist Party rally, which was a bunch of young people, right, mostly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to know this guy. When they have a problem, when they, you know, with the street or the house or paying a bill or something, you know what they do? They go down to their party headquarters, whether it's a Democratic Christian Party or whatever, and a very direct thing happens. You know,
the problem gets solved.
The government and their party directly. Now, screwed up as we might think some of those countries are, that just knocked me out.
You know, see, I don't think it's screwed up, Joe, that when the French bus drivers go on strike, the French school teachers go on strike, and when the school teachers go on strike, all the way down to the local magistracies, the magistrate won't show up. I don't think that's crazy. I don't think that's bad. I think that's a perfectly rational response for working people to an intractable situation. But we've got laws in this country that say that one union sympathy striking in support of another union is a violation of federal law, and the union reps can go to prison for it.
I didn't know that. Really?
Yes.
My God, how can solidarity ever be achieved?
That's kind of the point.
Is they walk into the darn party headquarters. It's the same thing in Belize, you know, the two, well now three parties, that in the small towns, and we don't have very many people down there, you know,
mm-hmm.
and there's, you know, the office of the party, and you walk in there and you say, you know, my end of town floods every time it rains because they haven't come down there and graded it, and by golly, a grader will get out there. It's their governor as crooked as ours. But a man can walk in and talk to the government.
And there's so much to be said for that. You know, we talk about this Employees' Free Choice Act. It's a card check agreement. And the idea being that if you want to organize a workplace, you pass out cards, and if 50% plus .00001 say, yeah, I want to be in the union, you got a union shop. And the right wing is having an absolute purple polka-dotted blue screaming hissy over this. They're having kittens with crocheted tails, and they're screaming that, well, it's anti-democratic. They're taking the secret ballot away from working people. What they're taking away is the ability of the management to haul the workers in and basically psychologically kneecap them before these dummied-up, ginned-up, bogus elections can take place.
I tried to organize a newspaper in this town years ago when I came back and made another stab at living here and trying to make some change. And, of course, you know, the owner of the paper's daddy was Harry Floodberg, or his granddaddy was. And the tactics were just incredible. We would meet, because the reporters were the more overeducated persons, but by God, there were pressmen down there on the line and said, yep, it's been too long, you get to your 19th year, you're ready to retire, and somehow you get cut loose. And the retirement fund, it turns out the owner's children benefit from it. Nobody ever retired from there. This was now made illegal. Anyway, so we're trying to organize a union. They sent guys out to come and copy everybody's license number at night and stand out there and look menacing. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
And this just went on.
And it means something.
On and on, and you couldn't believe it. Finally, an atmosphere of terror did prevail just through millions of little actions.
Bet I know how the vote went down.
Yep. It wasn't even close.
No.
In the end, the more educated reporters voted for it. The blacks voted for it. and the rest of them were scared for their jobs.
Well, not too awfully long back, within the last year or so, you remember when the transit workers went on strike in New York City?
Mm-hmm.
The head of that local went to jail over it because the transit workers in New York City, liberal New York City, Joe, do not have the right to withhold their labor. Now, when you don't have the right to withhold their withhold your labor, we're generally talking about a scenario that happened before 1860 and south of New York City.
Yep.
A good bit. But it's,
yep,
the same thing.
You still talk about human bondage in a way, a different kind.
If you cannot withhold your labor, you're darn right. And meanwhile, you know, maybe some people will think we're piling on. At roughly the same time, Hillary was showing up at the groundbreaking ceremony of the new Goldman Sachs building.
Yeah.
Where millions of dollars in corporate welfare had been doled out.
Getting caught being on the Walmart board. You know?
Yeah.
My editor edited his books, right? You know, and so she's a big Obama fan and a typical New Yorker, and that's fine. God, we love each other. We have fought and had tears and arguments over getting this book and getting it right and what I want to say and what the world doesn't believe or whatever. And I said, look, this guy graduated from Yale or Harvard. So did his dad. You know, this guy's trying to pass for black. Nothing wrong with him. He's got a good heart. He's got all these things that you guys
love
would like to see. The only thing that would be better is if he was a woman. But the fact of the matter is, he's rich. You know?
Yeah.
He declared $950,000 income last year. You know, he's a child of diplomats. And if he can mention a guy in Africa that father to have to go to Harvard. I mean, this stuff, you know, that image, they believe in this holographic kind of politics.
Don't show up at Dreamland in Tuscaloosa and expect me to think that, no, just because you show up at a barbecue joint or something like that does not make you a man of the people.
Right.
And I say that to white or black, either one.
Well, they're talking about electing a black. I said, man, first of all, he's going to have to convince blacks he's black. All my black friends, they go, you know, the Democrats, they tend to own the black vote, at least in areas I've lived. But we all sit around and laugh. You know, it's like, this is a little rich boy. He's still going to do better than any damn Republican candidate that they ever put up. But it's the idea, let's get an ordinary man. What happened to the Jacksonian, you know, tradition?
Well, there's Dennis Kucinich again, okay?
There he is again.
Dennis Kucinich still has his union card, Joe.
Oh, right.
He pays his dues. There were months on end in his life as a very young man when he lived in a car. And I guess that's the 20th century equivalent of growing up in a log cabin.
Yep. That's a nice way to put it. I may have to steal that leg, brother.
Consider it a gift, okay? He's been involved in government since he was 26 years old.
Oh, I know. I remember the stories about him when he was mayor. I remember an article called Dennis the Menacing Mayor of Cleveland.
Mm-hmm. And
at about to owning the utilities.
Yeah, and at the age
turned out to be good.
At less than 30, he stood up to the humongous banking interest who held the paper on the city of Cleveland and said, give us the municipal power and light company, and you won't go bankrupt. And he said, screw it, bankrupt us. We're hanging on to the power company, and they've still got it.
And aren't they glad?
Yeah, and they're very glad. And yet, if Dennis Kucinich can get any press, the first thing you hear usually is the man who bankrupted Cleveland.
Oh, I know.
Jumping Jehoshaphat, Joe. This is back when the river caught fire.
You know, I was living in Eugene, Oregon, for a while, and they have a strong old wobbly tradition.
Mm-hmm.
The old workers of the world, the woodsmen of the world, workers of the world, and they own their own utilities company. Just because that happened a long time ago, and they've refused to privatize. And my God, you know, your utility bills, all of it together, is $30 a month. There you go.
Obviously, it's clearly a failure because it's not participating in the stock market dynamic.
No.
I couldn't resist the voice. I apologize.
You check because they sold some of the juice.
Yeah, you know, we spent a bunch of public dollars here in the holler. To put in what in the country, you know the phrase, city water.
Uh-huh.
And that thing hadn't dripped out its first few gallons before the thing was put on the block and bought by West Virginia American Water, owned by American Water, owned by a British holding consortium, which is ultimately owned by a German outfit with the worst environmental record in all of Germany.
They're buying all the water in the world. The world might be 95% water, but only 2.5% of it's fresh water, and only 1% of it flows because the rest of it is frozen. And these guys are so smart. I'm watching it all over Latin America. You know, politically, they put in their own guys. They let the wells get really dirty and not taken care of. They let them become unsafe. And the Crystal Water Company is the devil on hooks. It's everywhere. And pretty soon the truck comes down the street, and a man is spending a quarter of his monthly income to buy fresh water for his babies. And this is happening all over the world. Africa, Haiti, the Caribbean, South America. I mean, we got enough of a water problem anyway.
And
can you imagine the privatization of water?
They're working on the privatization of air.
Really?
I'm not kidding.
You're not kidding.
Insofar as you've got the sweetheart deals that get passed for the coal companies and the power companies allowing them to pollute, and what are these pollution credits where you trade from point A to point B if it's not the privatization of whose air gets polluted?
Yeah, right, exactly. What else is a pollution credit? Now I get you.
So, I don't know what the answer is, Joe, and I don't know that anybody does. But a damn good starting place is getting working folks to realize, you know, to look at each other and realize they're working folks. I go back to the grand old tradition of the UMWA, the first fully integrated from the get go labor union, because everybody was black down in that hole, and they were black coming out. And so that union was integrated, and the first thing that those early organizers, God rest her soul, Mary Harris Jones, the first thing that they tried to teach those miners, and it was Hungarians, and it was Italians, and it was Southern blacks brought up from the coal fields in Alabama, and it was old Scots Irish who had their land stolen from them from the railroad company so that they were forced into indentured servitude in the hole. And the first thing they did was get them together and explain to them, let me make it clear, there's no black people here, there's no hunkies and no dagos. There's no wasps, there's no mix. There's workers.
It's like you said, they're all black when they come out of the mine.
Yeah. And once they got them to understand that there was only one class, working people, then they began to have a chance.
Well, I'll tell you, the last chapter in the book is called The American Hologram. And it's about Americans living in a self-referential media world of where television and media and distraction tells us about gleaming eagles and church spires and our boys in Iraq and all this. And it's almost the level of distraction and saturation makes it really hard to get a message through. But Malcolm X was right about something. He said, first you must educate the people. And I really believe that any permanent change is going to come from informing the people like she did. You get down there, and you got to get the truth to them, and you're going to have to be somebody they trust or at least speak their language face-to-face, and that's what I try to get in the book. You're going to have to be there on the barroom floor, and you're going to have to be downtown. You're going to have to help the guy that's got the plumber's butt crack, that's got the three dislocated discs that lays your carpet, you know?
Yeah.
You know, if you believe this stuff, you got to do it. Otherwise, you're too damn comfortable.
And have some level of identification. You're not better than the guy laying the carpet.
No, because I'll tell you, you'll soon be laying it.
Yeah.
There's starting to be a proletarianization of the college educated classes, because it's really there's a class system there. There's the Ivy League schools, and then there are this lower level that most of us will get our access to, the state university system that turns out the empire school teachers and all this and teaches them to indoctrinate, you know, working class people, you know, in things that just aren't true. And so with, you know, they,
There's a reason that civics get pulled
out of education.
Yeah, there's a reason that civics got pulled from the high school curriculum long about the time that I was graduating in the early 80s. If you're because nobody wanted to take civics. I took my ninth grade civics in summer school after eighth grade and got it out of the way. But I still had to take it, and I still had to learn a little bit about the structure of government.
Mm-hmm.
It was gone shortly after I graduated.
Isn't that amazing?
If you can take that away, you talk about the self-referential media world. In Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451. See, Michael Moore did that to me. Fahrenheit 451. You remember the fireman's wife lives.
It's been a long time, brother.
Yeah, lives in a house where there are giant television screens on all four walls.
Oh yeah.
And by virtue of computer communication, the dialogue in the TV shows that she watches include her name.
Mm-hmm.
And she can't understand why anybody would want to leave that group of people, leave that room, because they had become more real for her than she was herself. She could not be her without the media giving her own point of reference.
And that's exactly what I'm talking about in the last chapter. You know, you won't recognize the Matrix when you're in it.
Mm-mm.
You know, because we all get up in the morning and feel the same way in the same world, in the same consensual reality. But the difference is that we didn't give our consent.
Exactly.
We just agree, okay, this is the way the world works. We don't know why we agree the way. I mean, they don't have civics class, so the average high school graduate has no idea how the government works. About a quarter of the people don't know the difference between the House and the Senate. Isn't that something? A quarter of the people that voted.
Well, and then there's the, I mean, by the time you do the math, Joe, the quarter of the people that voted don't know the difference. But, you know, they might have voted for a guy for the Senate and thought he was going to that. It doesn't matter. He's my congressman. But beyond that, then you do the math of the people who sat at home. So if, say, the 2004 primary here in my county in West Virginia, the primary, the nominating process, the most, I preach that the important election is the primary. Because by the time you get to the general election, you are then officially in the wrestling match. And you're choosing between the guy in the red trunks with the red mask or the guy in the blue trunks with the blue mask. And one of them's going to win this year, but the thing's rigged and the other one will win next.
You know, when the heaviest fundamentalists started loading the primaries and staying so late that everybody wanted to go home? Remember that?
Yeah.
This all started back with the Gingrich and the Reagan and all that early when they started rolling the machine.
Exactly.
Are liberals so comfortable and distracted that they can't do that too?
Well, then that's the point. The 2004 primary in Fayette County, 30% of the registered voters showed up. That means that 15% of the registered voters chose the leadership for this county.
Uh-huh.
And that 15% is actually a subset of an even tinier subset of the entire population of the county, and it happens county by county by county by county, and it's people, and you go to the polls, and it's routinely a generation that's ahead of yours and ahead of mine.
Mm-hmm.
These are folks. You know, my father passed away in February. He would not miss an election because he had kamikazes try to kill him in the middle of the South Pacific, and he was by God going to show up. And the poll workers are 65 and 70 and 75 years old. My generation, the 40-somethings, you know, maybe we'll show up. We're not going to show up for the primary. We're only going to go to the big wrestling match. We're not going to go to the one down to Little Armory.
You know, and for most people, it's a televised popularity contest. It's bad enough that we elected a movie star. Someone once told me, I think you people will eventually elect Mickey Mouse. Well, I think we already have.
I think we elected Goofy, but
popularity contest. It means that your state is controlling your political consciousness. That hit me. This happened years ago. It hit me like a ton of bricks. Like, absolutely, that's it. You know, the media is our engagement with political knowledge. Therefore, the result of the process is not going to be through any actual engagement with reality, but rather, you know, the the signal.
It's going to be through engagement with the wrestling match.
Yeah, but look who's wrestling. They're all rich. The poorest guy makes $950,000 a year.
Yeah, and they've got an agreement. You know, I think Joe that
might not be spoken, but they do.
Well, for me, the rubber mask came off at Christmas after the 2004 election when I realized that now Arnold Schwarzenegger showed up at the Republican National Convention in September of 2004. And in reference to John Kerry, said, "Don't be economic girly men." Okay?
Yeah.
Christmas dinner after the 2004 election, after John Kerry refused to take the $40 million that he still had in his war chest and fight and contest the Ohio results, after all that had happened, he and Teresa flew to Sun Valley, Idaho, and sat down and broke bread at Christmas dinner with the man who called him a girly man.
Yes,
they had dinner with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and at that point in time, I felt like I had just peeked behind the temporary curtains that are erected around the wrestling ring, and I saw them all sitting back there drinking gin and tonic and talking about who was going to win the tag team match next week.
Like the Romans.
Yeah.
And it's, to them, it's a sport.
Only problem is, for us, it's a blood sport, Joe.
Right. But power is the sport of the rich, you know, and always has been.
Why can't they just go back to horse racing?
I don't know. I wish.
I don't know. It's enough to make you think we'd be better off with a monarchy sometimes. You know, so just wander off and be happy, raise dogs and race horses. And,
well, you know, that's it. That's me. It's dogs and kids, and when I go down to Belize, my soul is eased for a few months. I get to do something. I get to watch that an ordinary man can step out and do something and make a family's life better. Or do, you know, here everything is so indirect and so complex and full of agencies and laws and taxes, and you can't do anything direct. And so it gives me a whole lot of energy. This next book is probably going to be about liberation theology. But I'm not going to use any religious language, and I'm not going to use any political language. Do you know who Will Campbell is?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm going to spend some time with Will Campbell, and I am really looking forward to it, because I'm going to talk to some of the people who have been the fighters for labor with our people, and some of the people who have been theologians. And for those who are listening who don't know Will Campbell, you know, grew up son of a moonshiner. He led those four little black kids up those steps. He was a Baptist minister, you know, born fairly illiterate, and ended up being the dean of Harvard Divinity School. Lives in the log cabin, lives back there in Juliet, Tennessee, and is totally against the religious takeover. Won't set foot in half the Baptist churches in America, and he was head of the Baptist convention for many years.
Next time you drop him a line, see if you can entice him into a conversation here. I will.
You know, I'm so looking forward to this. People that, during the 60s, people that came to hide from the world, came to his house, included Martin Luther King, Thomas Merton. And so what I'm trying to do is I've been talking to people that have real morals, you know, that and regardless of religion, you know, and look at these things about America, about labor, and about I think there's some spiritual questions to be asked here, and I don't care what religion you're talking about.
I think labor is a spiritual undertaking, Joe.
It is.
I mean,
so I'm working toward that. In the meantime, I'm hoping, you know, that this book, the message goes out, and anybody that buys it, you can be assured, my friend, that the money is going to help some real people. It's not.
Well, let me ask you about the Belize angle, if I may, please.
Mm-hmm.
One, what made it Belize for you as opposed to Costa Rica or any other small country? Two,
English speaking.
Okay, see, that's what I guessed, because I have these, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, get up on the cross or anything, Joe.
No, no.
But five nights a week for 3 hours, I'm here behind this microphone, and it seems like I live in this toxic swamp of bad news. And there are times that I talk about just bugging the hell out.
Mm-hmm.
And Belize is always where I wind up looking at on my Google Earth program.
Yeah, You can't get away from it. It's there too.
So,
but it's not in control. And poverty is opportunity. It's not opportunity because you go get to be the big white iguana, but because you can put food in a baby's mouth, you can give someone a way to make a living. You can live where the air is absolutely clear there because of the narrowness of it and the way the Caribbean blows. And you can look at communities there absolutely still intact.
Well, is there? Let me just ask you. After this conversation, Joe, I hope it's okay for me to say this. I feel like I've known you forever. This is just a wonderful exchange. Let me ask you this: a place like Belize, is there room for a guy who's dangerous with a hammer and a nail in his hand?
Well, it's pretty interesting because I live among a minority there, the Garifuna people. Mm-hmm. They were a shipload of Nigerian slaves in 1566 that wrecked in a storm there, and they went ashore. And they built their own culture. They married the Carib Indians, an extinct kind that was here when Columbus came, but it's no longer here. But their African culture stayed intact. They're called the World Heritage Culture now, and they're trying to protect it by the UN. And I had been down there several times, but then when I found these people who live tribally, I mean, there's microwaves and TVs and stuff, but there's also grass huts and most houses are just little board things. You don't have any interior walls because it's hot, man. You're trying to get air to blow through this thing at night.
And somehow you don't need your Giorgio Armani tuxedo down there with you, do you?
Hey, I got to tell you a good George Bush story. His ambassador he sent down to Belize City, which is a great rotting old colonial city, where all the races mix and all the cultures. So the first thing the guy does is he has a big formal dinner for the 100 most important Belizeans. There ain't any rich people. There's some rich people. Yeah, that's true. There are. Anyway, only 35, and it was, you had to wear a coat and tie. Only 35 people showed up because there were only 35 coats and ties to be borrowed.
Oh, Lord. You're doing a bad thing to me, Joe. You're really pouring fuel into the bug out machine.
Well, you can't escape, though. I mean, their government's corrupt, too. The DEA has a big, heavy hand down there. Most people have been very much colonialized. I fell in love with the Garifuna because they may have been... They're a little bit brainwashed by television, but you know what? We watch Al Jazeera, and we watch Cuban stations at night, and we see different viewpoints.
Well, obviously, you're wired into the electronic revolution and everything. You were penning columns from down there.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of technological infrastructure is there? I mean,
there's one internet cafe. This is a village of 1,000 people, stretched over 2 miles, because a fishing village would have one hut, the boat in front, and off to sea you go, all of you together. It's got a dozen gringos or whatever there now, and a little bit of tourism, but it's a dirty third world place. That's not where most people want to go yet. And we got about 8 cars, 4 of which are running at any time.
The other 4 of which are for parts.
Everywhere you go. If you need to go to get a prescription, they don't have prescriptions. My doctor is Juan Castro put there, and she is good. But if I want to go to the gringo doctor, there's one from Southern California, and she's very good. A doctor's visit is $7 by law.
Jiminy.
And if I need anything, I have to get on the bus, and I have to pay $1. It's $2 Belizean to 1 American, and ride 37 miles to get anything. But all things being equal, I consider it just about the right level to live in the world. And their community is totally intact. It operates. There's an anthropologist who was born there, and so he explains a lot of things to me. You think people are gossiping, but what it is communication about who needs food, whose baby needs to do this. And it isn't that primitive. I mean, hell, I can do anything. Anyway, they have an internet cafe. They have cable TV because all it takes is a dish and a wire down the middle of the street. So the Belizean government put these in for communications everywhere. So a German guy opened an internet cafe, and I go there because I want to support it. I want to see him. So he has a certain amount of bandwidth. He has 12 computers. The surf sloshes on your feet because it's also what we call the meat locker, where there's 12 computers in there to keep the salt water, the air, from eating them up.
Yeah.
And it's a huge thatched hut, maybe 30 feet across, 40 feet across. And in the middle is a bar, open air. And you can sit there with your computer if you want, and at a high tide, let the water run across your feet. Or you can lay in a hammock by the sea.
My lovely wife is halfway out the door, Joe.
But, you know, there's a downside.
I'm sure there is.
It's not dirt cheap like people think. You got to live like they live. You got to like rice and beans. You got to like fish. You
live
like
simply so that others may simply live.
Huh?
Live simply so that others may simply live.
Well, I'll tell you, I got down there, and when I saw how they did rice and beans and so on, I said, hell, it's Southern cooking, man.
Well, you say rice and beans, and you're not telling me I'm stepping down the culinary ladder, because it, no, that's I had rice and beans for lunch today.
Pigs' tails, the rich people eat.
Yeah.
When you go to, they don't have a frozen food industry or anything like that, but it's getting there fast in the cities. We have what we call the Chinaman store that's bringing entirely too many processed foods in. But most people are still too poor to do it. But
now, I want something wrapped in a banana leaf and steamed.
The poor. Or this isn't people stumbling around sick.
No.
These are simple people in the sun, children of the sea.
How just out of curiosity, is there an elderly Garifuna population?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, folks get old there?
Yeah, their society, they practice two religions. There's the Catholic Church, which all the schools there are run by churches because the government never had enough money once they got independence in the early 70s, I think it was, late 60s. The churches run the school. The government funds the school. So they got the Catholic Church, which is big in their society, but then their own religion called Dugu, which they bought from Africa. And it's a religion where you're in constant touch with your ancestors for advice. And they have these long thatched temples and churches. I don't even know. I don't go in there. I'm a white man. I respect whatever they do. And all night drumming. And as it turns out, they tell me that actually speaking in tongues in the Pentecostal church came from the African slaves. I did
not
know
surprised.
That, but, and it's speaking in tongues, communicating with the ancestors. They also, a lot of them, even the young people, their culture is very intact because their language is intact. You know, but yeah. They speak perfect English. I mean, and they know what law and order is on television. It's complicated.
I'm guessing you don't have to lock up the guitar when you walk out the hut.
No, definitely not, because your houses are so close together. You wish there was a little more privacy.
Mm-hmm.
Kids come jump into bed with me at dawn, you know. It's like, school's out. And, you know, so I'm old, fat, white Uncle Joe. And, you know, we'll go over to the Chinaman store and we'll get a jar of orange juice, you know. We got fruit trees in the yard and all this stuff. But, you know, here's a country that raises oranges right in their district. And poor man can't afford a glass of juice.
God almighty.
Because the American companies own it.
Oh, let's all sing the national anthem, Joe. It was freezing my butt off, and it was that particular Jimmy Buffett tune I was listening to the other day. I read your first article where he sings, "They're freezing up in Buffalo, stuck in their cars, and I'm lying here neath the sun and the stars." Oh, the name of the tune's Manana.
Yeah.
But no, it's not all easy. But
the children get tapeworm. The dogs kill each other in the yard. In the world, man.
It's a brutal place. The world is a brutal place.
Yeah, and you know, they're very peaceful, loving people. You don't see any violence. I mean, you know, there's no violence. When you only got like 1,000 people, you don't steal anything from anybody, man.
Well,
you don't dare, because the worst thing that can happen is you'll be shunned by the village. We had a kid, 19 years old, kicked a guy in the knee and took his chicken dinner, and he was shunned by the village. And
his life got real bad real fast.
He slept on my porch for days. He'd come in late at night, lay in the hammock, and get up in the morning before I left. It was a community. Well, I think all of us, it was very odd because over the last couple of years, I've been welcomed into an extended family, and I, I, feel so strange about being an elder because I'm 60 years old. And I go, come on, I can't be that damn old. But I am allowed to participate, you know, because, I mean, I help the kids get to school. I help fix dinners and things like that. But when I saw what it meant when you're excommunicated from that community that's been sitting there for 200 years or whatever, it's a very, very serious thing. And it holds people together.
As it should be.
They drift around in the evenings. You'll see a couple families drifting along, and they'll stop in a house for about 15 minutes at 6 o'clock, say, and the next house, and the next house. Well, that's the family that doesn't have anything to eat tonight. That's very gracious.
And they get something to
eat.
And
then next week, it might be the house you're sitting at. So these are all things that evolved over 1,000 years. You know, these little practices. The anthropologist has shown me this is the matrix of community.
And, it, you know, the thing that impresses me, Joe, is it sounds like you've taken some of that and you've bothered to wonder, which is a huge step, you've bothered to wonder if that can be restored here.
Yeah, it's... I don't know. I don't know because I never saw it intact before. I've only seen it once before, and that was down with the Mayan Indians. But the language barriers and the cultural barriers were so great, I didn't know what I was looking at. I was up the Mopan River, where they still practice Mopan agriculture, and you see 500 Mayan huts, the smoke coming through the roof. They don't do chimneys, dogs, children, you know, Mopan corn. And it was too hard to penetrate. I knew that what I was seeing there was a living organic community of man. But the Garifuna, they speak Garifuna, they speak English, and they speak Pidgin English. And so the English part of it enables me to start to get a grasp on how they relate to each other and how they love one another. And like I don't have any grandchildren. So I just love it. The kids come up there at night, we pop popcorn and watch television. You know? I mean, it sounds like a dumb thing, but...
No, no, it doesn't.
Western movies, hell.
You're reminding me very much, Joe. We've got a good friend of the program, a young man by the name of Jeff Biggers, wrote a brilliant book that you might, I don't know, next trip, take it with you.
I don't know why.
The name of the book is The United States of Appalachia. I think you would find it incredibly gratifying to read. But he also wrote one recently, it was a labor of love, called In the Sierra Madre.
Mm.
And it's an experience...
Is it the Hispanic version of the Appalachians?
It is exactly that.
Yep, because I've been down through the Sangre de Cristo and saw the same thing.
His sojourns with the Rarimuri people. And he describes situations that are circumstances that are very similar to what you're describing. The work, you know, communal work parties, they make something there called Tesquino.
Mm-hmm.
It is a corn-based beer.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll get drunker than lords building fences, roofing homes. And, you know, the Tesquino party comes to your house next week and does whatever you need done.
God, I love it. And it's not quite that organized there, but what'll happen is somebody will walk by and see somebody's... Well, like on my place, Eldon, the young man that did the work, I don't have the health anymore. I've got some pretty bad health problems. And coming down the street, sand road, would climb up there and help him for a half hour. Just because, hey, guy needs a hand, you know.
Yeah, and, well, you know, you still see a good bit of that here in West Virginia, here in the hills. And it's one of the things that...
I think there's a large element here, but one of the things... And it's going to be going on too late, so I'm going to have to get off of here. But
one of
the things is, it's very hard for an American to get it that they do not value a job. People say, the Garifuna are so lazy. The Garifuna don't want a job. They have about a 70% unemployment in our village. There's resorts at each end. The people that work there make about... $40 a week, well, a dollar and a quarter an hour, whatever that would come to. About a dollar and a quarter an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trapped. They're slaves, you know. It's a different kind of slavery. But the average, there's a lot of young men and a lot of older men, they've been fishermen all their lives. They do not value a job. Well, the white people think they're so damn lazy. You know, they get up every day and they do what it takes to make their world go round, and then they're done.
Yeah, right? instead of a job, they've got a life.
A mango tree, and we sip a little bitters, and they talk about life. One day there, and then I'll shut up. But you've hit something that's dear to my heart. I was sitting with a bunch of the older people. There's no age thing there, you know. But I was sitting with them, and I started telling them about global warming. Now, these are men; these old men, they can sail by the stars. You know, they sailed the big 40-foot dugouts when a man to buy so much as a fish hook had to go to sea, you know, for a day and a night, because there were no roads to the village up until recently. And I started telling them about global warming, and they started crying because they had seen the dead reefs, and they knew that it was a true thing. And I was so goddamn sorry I ever said it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
I mean,
there's the man who's dying, and there's the man who knows he's dying.
Yes, and I should never have opened my stupid gringo mouth about how it's all working, because they knew it was the truth. They've seen it, but they didn't need to hear the explanation.
Jesus.
You know, so that's how, you know, you go and you pollute an environment. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. And Joe, on that, we'll wrap. I hope you don't mind the amount of time I've taken from this evening.
Oh, no, not at all.
It's
talking to Ken.
This has been one of the most glorious conversations I've had in doing this, and I've been doing this for since 2003.
Well, let's do more. Is there a capability to do call-in?
Oh, absolutely. Anytime.
We can do that. You know, I mean, this is...
Tell your friends and neighbors. I mean, like I said, we're not kidding when we say we're trying to foster dialogue and discussion here.
I think it's a great thing, man. I mean, let's do it.
All right.
You know, there's two or three. I mean, you know, there's a network going on out there, isn't there?
Yeah, there is.
Yep.
There's a hunger. There is a hunger. Because, you know, at the same time that you and I have been talking, I've been watching a small army of people in our chat room who are discussing what we're discussing among themselves. This is interactivity on a level that terrestrial radio and satellite radio can never even dream of approaching.
Exactly.
And privately and individually, there are emails, as you and I speak, there are emails flying back and forth, people carrying on private message conversations. There is more hope for dialogue, and I'm not trying to toot my own trumpet. I'm talking about the medium as opposed to me. There's more hope here for an American connectedness than there is in any amount of, you know, Viacom-owned CBS or GE-owned NBC or Disney-owned ABC.
Well, that's what I always say. You know, they may have their great media hologram, but we can build one, too.
And you are, and I've been told to inform you that you are oh so welcome to drop by the chat room.
Oh, well... tell me how.
HeadOnRadioNetwork.com and just click chat room and register and you're there.
Yeah, well, now I might not do it tonight because I've been a little sick lately. But, you know, I'm not a great internet cruiser and everything, but I like straight ahead talk with people in things like the chat rooms and the bulletin boards, you know.
Well, I think you might enjoy this, Joe.
No, I don't bullshit people. I'll do it.
Yeah.
Anybody can phone me. People don't believe that I really answer all my own email and I take phone calls. And the reason we have people here at our house is it's like-minded people have been coming through here for 2 years now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from the broke back carpet layer with 9 bad discs to Jimmy Carter's speechwriter. It's been like a miracle. And it's all the internet, you know.
Yeah.
So anybody can write me at joebajan@joebajan.com.
And my apologies on the mispronunciation.
They can call me, you know, because just because it makes my world better too, man.
And that's the same thing that happens for me. I mean, I sit here for 3 hours a night, and I guess a lot of people who do what I do it ego driven. I'm humbled by this, Joe.
Yes, me too. Me too. Well, I think something's going on that. You know, I meet a lot of young people, and some of them suspect that something great was going on in the 60s, and they've been told a big lie about what was going on. Something wonderful was afoot, hope. And we never doubted that everything that we were going to be able to make everything all right. So the big lie has been, oh, well, they were young and they were stupid. Well, what came out of it was everything from the health food movement to all kinds of things. And my own children felt cheated, you know, because in their generation they felt like nothing happening. This is happening. This is it.
Yeah.
You know, this cyber thing, this other architecture of information, architecture of the heart, communication. I know America when I'm seeing it. You know, I've seen one or two in my life, and this is it. I mean,
well, come on back and participate in the miracle anytime you want to, Joe. I consider you a friend, and I consider an honor to have a conversation of this depth and this extent and this length.
It's mutual, man. I'll tell you, I don't look forward to radio things, but please, anybody, go ahead. I answer all my emails. I mean, it takes. There's hundreds of them, and if somebody's picking at me, no, I won't take it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we have an open door, open heart policy here.
Well, thank you very kindly, and I wish you the very best and have a wonderful night. Great strength to you as you go through the book tour, and please stay in touch.
Okay, well, you take care, my friend, and you say hello, and I'll get in that chat room. Probably not right now, though. I'm going to have to go rest a little while.
That's fine. Any old time.
But I will. And drop me an email with any further information about connecting with people there.
Oh, I sure will. I sure will. I'll give you the whole schedule and everything.
Okay.
All right?
You take care.
You take care, Joe. Thank you again.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Wow. I feel like I've been doused in ice-cold fresh water, don't you? That's it for the show. We've got to wrap it up right now. No credits, no nothing. Just one thing. RMR. Gina. It's all for you.
Fighting re-erupted today, breaking the on-off truce between Lebanese troops and the Islamic militants in a Palestinian refugee camp. An estimated 111 people have died in the clash between the two factions, while thousands of settlers have fled the camp. You're listening to the Quality News Network. Science and business are next.
Hello, I'm CHP Officer Felix Isararas. Law enforcement officers throughout the state are committed to removing drunk drivers from California roadways before they kill or injure themselves, or worse, an innocent victim. Right now, local law enforcement and the CHP are conducting DUI checkpoints to find drunk drivers and keep California roads safe.
Always designate a sober driver. And if you see a drunk driver on the road, call 911. A message from the Office of Traffic Safety and California Highway Patrol.
Remember the time you almost volunteered to work in a soup kitchen? Or when you almost visited the Veterans Hospital? Or when you almost brought dinner to your neighbor with AIDS? Remember all the times you almost helped, almost gave? Well, it's only human, this almost giving. But the truth is, it's the same as not giving at all. Don't almost give, give. Visit our website at don'talmostgive.org. A message from the Ad Council.
Biologists in California say the two lost whales that made a trip 90 miles up the Sacramento Delta may now be back in the Pacific Ocean. They haven't been sighted today and likely slipped beneath the Golden Gate Bridge last night. Barbara is right on schedule. Tropical storm season officially begins June 1st in the Pacific, and Barbara is gaining strength as it idles about 125 miles off of Puerto Angel. The storm is forecasted to move up the coast to Acapulco by Monday. And Lake Okeechobee, America's second